Hi, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. By the way, it looks like I'm coming through. Okay. Today is Monday, July 10th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network or you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250. Our participant code is 449-389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side. And anybody that's not donating, please consider doing so. We are in serious need of money. We've been in need of money for quite some time. Again, struggling with bills, and we're late with a couple bills already, and it's just a struggle. $5 a month or more, goodness, that's, you just give up a coffee and a roll and donut once a month, and $5. All right, anyway. Okay, tonight's scripture reading, let's see, let me open up the good book here. Tonight's scripture reading is going to be in Matthew. We're going to continue in Matthew. We're in chapter 12. We're going to read 38 through 50. So chapter 12, 38 through 50. Then certain of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, "Master, we would see a sign from thee." But he, the Lord Jesus, answered and said unto them, "An evil and an adulterous generation seeketh after a sign. And there shall be no sign be given it to it, but the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." And of course there is a spiritual picture here, but there's also a literal picture here of the resurrection. "The men of Nineveh shall rise up in judgment with this generation, and shall condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and because a greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation, and shall condemn it. For she came from the uttermost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, a greater than Solomon is here. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places, seeking rest, and findeth none. Then he saith, I will return unto my house from whence I came out. And when he is come, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh with himself seven other spirits, more wicked than himself. And they enter in and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so shall it be also unto this wicked generation." While he yet talked to the people, behold, his mother, his brethren, stood without, desiring to speak with him. Then one said unto him, "Behold, thy mother, thy brethren, stand without, desiring to speak with thee." But he answered and said unto them that told him, "Who is my mother? Who are they that are my brethren?" And he stretched forth his hands towards his disciples and said, "Behold, my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of my Father, which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother." Okay, that was Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 through 50. All right, this week, tomorrow, what meeting is coming up tomorrow at 9 p.m. in this room, Jan? Is there a meeting going on?
That's the courtroom observers.
Okay, well, we're going to take up a little bit of that time. I don't think it's going to take very long. We're going to consider an indictment. I think it's important. And I think it's timely. With the judge that came in, decided to, you know, make himself king, decided to come into our courtroom and decided to take the mantle away from the magistrate that was already in that courtroom, and of course, away from the tribunal, which ultimately at this point in time, until a jury is decided, that would be the grand jury. And decided to just shut things down. We wrote him a writ of error, And we also made mention of this and sent copies to others, President and Jeff, the United States Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. I think it's important that we do an indictment and let it sit in the court. Whether we can get any motion on it or movement on it at this point in time, I think a message needs to be sent. Anyway, I'm going to make a case on that tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm not going to have much to say, but we'll make the case. And it shouldn't take but a few minutes. Anybody that would like to come in and sit on that grand jury and cast a vote, yay or nay, and listen in, is welcome to come to that meeting that will be tomorrow at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here in this room. Jan, maybe you can get a special message out to that and
sure.
to everyone, and making sure, you know, give all the details of where the meeting is going, you know, to be as far as, don't send them to the Monday night page to find it, because some people will be coming maybe that have never been there. Give me exact details, the call-in number and so on. Keep it short. But anybody who wants to sit in on this and as a grand jurist is welcome. A prerequisite, a requirement in order to cast any kind of a vote here is that you read the two papers. And if you go to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, click on docket, or go to grand jury, I mean, go to nationallibertyalliance.org/docket, okay? And the two papers you want to read for consideration of indictment is 1024, Unlawful Order to Dismiss, and 1024-01, Writ of Error, Final. So those are the two documents people should read. You know, everybody, all these documents should have been read by everyone. And these documents themselves are an education. And it also teaches you how to put together a, you know, a paper for a court. But anyway, these two documents particularly must be read in order to make a decision. I'm going to probably make a case, maybe Gerard will make a case, but it'll only be, maybe a couple of minutes concerning, because pretty much it's written in these two papers. You'll see the judge's position and what he's doing, and you'll see the position, our position concerning the writ of error and what crimes that he has committed by trying to walk and take into this courtroom and take over the case and shut it down. And the worst crime really is called concealment. Excuse me. So concealment is one of the crimes. And I believe concealment carries as much as 20 years. You know, there is a defined statement of time that the legislators have put together for anyone who is an elected or an appointed individual who conceals, particularly a judge. And appointed a time of 20 years. Of course, a jury could do whatever they want in that decision-making, but that is what the code says. And the jury could give a year, it could give 100 years. Of course, that would be ridiculous, I think, 100 years. But I'm making a point that the jury can make its own decision. So the trial jury will make whatever decision it wants to make if we do get an indictment. An indictment would be a 50% of all the people that attend. What we need is 50 plus percent, you know. All right, so again, anybody that wants to come to that and participate tomorrow evening, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in this room, and you must read those two documents in order to cast your decision. Anybody who would like to make a case or make any statements at that time before we make a vote is permitted to do so, staying focused on the case alone. We're not going to do questions. We're not going to do questions and answers. We're not going to do discussions of this or that or the other thing. We're going to stay focused on the two papers, and if anybody wants to make a position or anything about anything in those papers or whether for or against the individual for indictment or against the indictment, they're welcome to do that. But then we'll take a final vote, and that will rule the day. And if we get an indictment, then it'll be written and served onto the court. We'll file a copy with the president. We'll file a copy with Jeff Sessions, and we'll start pushing things a little harder. We also are going to – this kind of sets the stage to move now towards the magistrate of the case, which has been very idle. He hasn't said anything. He hasn't done anything. But he had a duty to do two things, and he hasn't done it. So after this potential indictment, we're then going to send a show cause. He needs to act or show cause why he's not acting. We're also, I think we're at a point, I have to look at the charts, I think we're at a point where we have maybe a half a dozen or so, maybe more, I don't know, of other cases that have defaulted, and we're going to write some default papers, if that is the case, and get it in. If it hasn't defaulted yet, they're coming up close. So we do have some other cases. And we're going to start pressuring this judge again. And the key is to get the court to react. And until they react, you know, that's where the pressure is. So, all right, anybody has any questions on these things, you can ask those questions during tonight's meeting. But again, tomorrow will not be a Q&A. It'll only be for people to make a if they want, someone wants to speak, make a position concerning the case, what's going on, their opinion and thoughts. Again, focusing in only on the two papers at hand. Okay. We are still doing non-judicial foreclosures. We're still taking affidavits. We are organizing across the nation. Everyone should be involved. We are a grassroots movement, ultimately. We're trying to build grassroots, get the grassroots to take the power and the authority. And before taking power and authority, they have to get knowledge. And that's what National Liberty Alliance is all about. And, of course, we're building grand jury administrations because that is the most powerful way for the people to take the power on the grassroots level. We're also building committees of safety. People need to be more involved. I might try to attend the next committee of safety, and I'd like to see what's going on. It's been a while since I've attended those meetings, and I used to run some of them from time to time, but I'd like to know where we are in the committees of safety. You know, does all the people involved, do they have a committee of safety going? At what point, where are they? You know, we need to start pressing towards getting more and more membership within the committees of safety, and of course within National Liberty Alliance. We need more grand jury administrators. We have a little over 1,000 potential administrators, people who have applied for that job. So we have about 1,000. We need about 13 or 14, maybe even 15,000 across the nation. But we got 1,000 at this point in time. And I do believe that once we hit critical mass, a lot of people are going to be filing in for those positions for numerous reasons. Number one, they are powerful positions, and we should not be abusing those powers. Our powers should be focused in towards empowering justice and not ourselves. And anybody who does empower themselves, we have a process of getting rid of those people. But the point is empowering justice, getting justice in our courts. So that these positions are very important positions. They have their powerful power and authority to the individual, again, who needs to be walked very humbly with this and give the power and the authority to the people, because that's what grand jury administrators really are. We're the investigative body for the grand jury. And we also have the opportunity to orientate both the grand jury and trial juries within the counties. It's also a paid position. Right now there are people who are paid to do these things, to pull the grand jury, to orientate them, and go through the process of their needs. This has become a puppet process for either in the court or in the or with the prosecutor who is seeking indictments. So we the people have to take control of that. Okay, we're also building committees of safety. Again, if you don't have a committee of safety started in your county and you're not involved in a committee of safety in your county, then what are you doing? because that's where real power and authority is, to bring the message, to bring the information, to bring the education to the people, to get them together, to talk with the sheriff, to get connected with your sheriff, to empower your sheriff, and then to get your sheriff to work with you with all within all the towns and villages and cities within your county. And the whole process, again, is really to protect the people. It's the Committee of Safety, and it's the job of the sheriff. He needs to understand this, and we need to get behind that sheriff in that process to protect the people of that county. And this sheriff, of course, needs to understand that he is the top cop. He has total control in an emergency. No federal agency, nothing, has more power or authority than that sheriff in that county during an emergency. We wrote a lot of papers on this, got a lot of information on this, and if anybody, you know, hasn't read these things, you need to go to that page on Committees of Safety, find out what's going on. And again, if you don't have a Committee of Safety in your county, start one. Find two or three people, partnership with them, and get one going. And if there is one already started in your county, join it and start working together with them. Okay. Before we go to announcements, Jan, do we have any questions?
No questions this week.
Nothing. Okay. Any announcements?
I would like to make one. Wednesday nights at 8, before the courtroom observers meeting each week, we have the ham net practice, and we've been studying the requirements for a ham license. We need people who are interested, serious about getting a ham license so they can use their bofangs, or we need a certain number of people also who have the wherewithal to buy a lower frequency rig, a high frequency rig, so-called. It's more costly than the bofangs, but we need that to develop the net that we're working on. So I would like to invite everyone on the call and any friends and so on that aren't on the call to please come to our meeting at 8:00 Eastern Time each Wednesday night and join us, and we would enjoy having you. That's all I have.
How's things going on the Natural Healing Committee? They've been meeting. What's going on with that?
Yes. Yes. Thursday nights at 8:00, we've been meeting. We've had three meetings so far. Robert's going to mention that in a minute here. He has an update for us on the Natural Healing Committee. We've been posting on the website. If you go there and look under the committees and then the Natural Healing Committee, we keep adding stuff each week that's of interest to people that are interested in the natural healing techniques and so on. So please go there and check it out. We'll keep adding things for you.
All right. I'd like to say I've had a lot of success with natural healings, dealing with, particularly for me, it's been with herbs and vitamins, most particularly, and some supplements, and amazing results from that. I was taking painkillers at least, once a day to go to sleep. Pain was too great. I think I've taken maybe four or five painkillers in the past month. So that's how much a reduction. I don't take them during the day. I suffer with the pain. I forget the pain's there during the day, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, my pain's pretty much gone. I had quite a few ailments that I've been working on, and they're all pretty much gone. And it's all, I really lay it all out to, taking vitamins and supplements, and also exercising. Exercising is an important part of anybody's health. If you do, you could do a lot of things, and if you don't exercise, forget about it. You got to do some exercising. I've really developed a weightlifting plan. Maybe I'll share it with people in the future. It's pretty intense, exercise. And within two days, every muscle of my body is exercised. And it also the cardio, what do they call it, cardio exercise, where you really get the breathing going, and the stress in order to get that, your blood pressure pumping to get that healthy too. So, but anyway, I need to check out that that program myself. Maybe this week I'll try to visit that too. All right, anything else before we move on?
Not that I have.
I know I saw a question. I don't remember what it was, and I don't remember that we had seen it. I'll look, and if I don't think we've looked at it in the past week, so I'll bring it up next time. But anyway, now Robert wanted to bring something up.
Yes, he had some announcements.
Yeah.
Robert?
I we've been having meetings of the committees, and on Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, we have the courtroom observers meeting. And, this last week we had more people than normal because I think we're finally getting some interest going. And I want to put out the word that I'm actually looking for somebody that is interested in being a leader involved with courtroom observers, somebody that has some knowledge about being a courtroom observer, somebody that has some knowledge about being in the courts. There's things that we want to get out to everybody to help everybody be more professional in that area of courtroom observing. And so I'm looking for some leadership. Now, on Thursday night, we have natural healing at 8 p.m. Eastern. We've laid the foundation with the importance of water and the cleansing and fasting. And this week we're getting into the individual herbs, you know, what they are and how to use them and what they're good for, what we can do with them. I think it's going to be a very interesting week. And we are growing. The listenership on this last Thursday was higher than it was before. And so the word is getting out and people are coming in, and I think it's really at the point now where it's really going to get interesting, and so I'd like to see more people there. And then at 9 p.m. Thursday night, we have the committees of safety meeting. Now we have a man doing a very fine job of teaching the people there what the committees of safety can do and how, and it's become very interesting, and we have a pretty good group of people coming in every week. I of course would like to see many more, and I think that it's very important that we get people into these committee meetings. I mean, with what we're looking at coming up, I think it's very important that we get organized, that we become knowledgeable on what we the people can do for ourselves. And I think that we've got a good start on doing this, and so I invite everybody to come on in. Thank you.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to add to what Robert just said, the Courtroom Observers website page, we have added some things to that. I would recommend everybody check the different committees from time to time, because as we learn things and come up with things, we post them on the website. And we recently added a kind of a checklist that people can use when they go into the court to kind of delineate what the different violations that they might experience or see the judge doing, and give them some ideas for what notes to make and what the violations might be, so they can use that when they write up their affidavits after they come out. So please,
absolutely,
from time to time, check these things. We keep putting little goodies in there for you, and we'd like you to go there and check them out. And that's all I've got.
Thank you, John.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Jan. And also, you know, we've got quite a few committees going. So I'd like to invite any of the committee leadership, you know, if they have any kind of a comment or maybe just bringing things to people's attentions or updating us on something, you know, just want to speak about what their committee is about, what they're doing, and looking to build that membership in those committees. Get a hold of Jan and let him know you'd like to get some time, and we'll pull you in at the beginning of our Monday night program. Try to get that word out to all the committee leaders there, Jan, that, you know, they should get up and talk about their committees from time to time on our Monday night program. Let people know that their committees are active and doing things, and some people might want to join once they get to understand what some of these committees are doing. But everyone should be active somewhere, doing something. You know, I get email from time to time, you know, or I get, you know, a person making a comment concerning, you know, well, you know, where you at, what are you doing, and, you know, why hasn't things happened yet? Well, a lot of things have happened. They're just not paying attention. Things take time. You know, things can't happen overnight. They take time. But we have come a long way in, I don't remember, 6 years or whatever it is. I think it's the end of 2012, I believe, is when we started to moving with the grand jury. So what's that, five years. So we've been working at this for 5 years, and we have accomplished a lot in 5 years, tremendous amount of stuff. We have constructed a pretty darn good website, tremendous amounts of information, education. We've developed, you know, a couple of courses that you can come online and take, the civics course, which is a long course. It's 120 hours. It takes time, mostly a lot of videos and audios and then some few, you know, questions at the end. But very interesting stuff. If you really want to learn about American history, we've got a great American history in that, you know, lectures in that study, in that particular course. We also have a constitutional course. That could be done in about 6 hours, maybe eight hours. You could do it on a Saturday easily. And everyone should be taking these courses. If people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. A little bit of my own words in there. That's Thomas Jefferson quote, but it's not going to happen. You know, I talk to people who think they understand liberty, and once I get talking about what liberty is all about, it's all brand new to them. They never heard it before. They don't understand. And I express the fact to them, if you don't know these things, you can't be free. Because someone's going to take it away from you. You can't have it. We have to defend it. We have to understand it. We have to be able to define it, at least for ourselves, and then defend it. And if we're not defining it for ourselves and we're not defending it, then we're losing it. Because rest assured, evil is working day and night to take that away from you. Okay, so anyway, everybody should be involved. If you're not involved in your grassroots movement of building committees of safety, you know, look, at maybe you've got, you belong to some liberty group. I got to believe all of our members, if not most of our members anyway, belong to local liberty groups. And maybe they're not that active. Maybe they only go once every 6 months. I don't know. I mean, we've had some big meetings here in my county over the years. We filled up a stadium one time, small stadium, but it's a stadium, a ballpark. And but that, you know, generally speaking, you don't get that many people come to a lot of these liberty groups. But if you belong to a liberty group, whether you're active or inactive, you should get back together with them and bring them the information, committees of safety. They can continue as a liberty group and doing whatever it is that they're doing. If they're trying to get people elected, then they've gone insane because they just do the same thing over and over again. We've been doing that year by year in our liberty groups, and nothing ever changes. But people need to get involved on their local level and get power. And how do you get power? Start committees of safety. By empowering your sheriff, you empower yourself. People need to understand that. And when you empower your sheriff and then you empower yourself through the empowerment of that sheriff, then you start to get the towns and the villages and whatever little cities within those counties that are around working together with your sheriff, and therefore they're working with you. And they're educated in what is most important, how to protect liberty, how to protect the justice system within their county. And so that's what the Committees of Safety is all about, okay, is getting involved in the grassroots and working with their sheriff. And if the sheriff just won't participate, then look to find someone who's running for sheriff and support. Find out what they think and give them a piece of meat here and a meat there. In other words, something that gives them an understanding of the Constitution, understanding of what liberty is, what our founding fathers said, you know. And little by little, you know, they'll get a little educated. Little by little, they'll start to get a little closer to what it is that you're talking about or doing. But remember, you got to work with your sheriff. If you're going in there to battle with them, to argue with him, to try to tell him that he's got to believe or he's got to do or he's got to understand or he's got to learn or whatever, then you're not going to get anywhere with them. So anyway, by the way, I'm having problems with my conference dashboard. Am I coming through still on Linode, Jen?
Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay, all right. I don't know what's going on with my board. Maybe I'll just refresh that page. But anyway, look at people got to get involved locally. That's where the power is. That's the power is in the people, in the grassroots, looking and dealing with problems within your community. Everyone should be doing that. And if we're all doing that, we're fixing the big problem. Okay. National leaders aren't important. It's the grassroots leadership that's important. And again, you know, working it out with your sheriff, developing a relationship with him, for good or for bad, for where he's at is one thing. But, you know, little by little, you'll start moving him towards the truth if you're bringing in real good information that he cannot deny, you know. Bring in the truth. The truth sets everybody free. Okay. Let's see. Gerard, you got anything before we move forward?
I'm good.
You're good. Okay. Okay, I'm going to try to get my board back, but first what I'll do is I'll introduce Brent Winters. Brent, are you here? Is Brent with us tonight? I don't have my board in front of me.
I looked earlier and didn't see him, but he may have come in late.
Brent, if you're there, pipe in, *6 to unmute yourself. And let me try to get on. See if you can find him.
Okay.
Gerard, look, see if you can find him, and Jan, everybody that has a board open, see if you can find him. I'm going to try to open my board now again. I don't know. I've used two different browsers on this and have problems with both of them. I came on with my, goodness, what is it? The, can't even think of the name of this one.
Yeah.
You don't see him?
I don't see him.
Okay, I guess Brent's not on tonight. Let me just take one quick look, too. Okay. I guess he's not with us tonight. If you are out there and we don't see you, at some point, you know, interrupt us, let us know, and we'll move back over to you. All right. Meanwhile, we'll go straight on to Q&A. So anybody's got any questions or comments, hit *6 and whatever else it tells you to do, *2 or whatever, I don't know, *1. And get into the queue. We've got a couple of people in the queue right now, so we'll get started with our first question. Ollie from Colorado, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
What's up, man? This is Jeremiah from Northern California. I hope everyone's doing really good.
Good.
I'm all about the
I don't even see you here. How did you get in here? You were the first one? Do you see him on your board?
I guess I was the first one. I don't know.
He's there. Your board must be locked up, John.
It's a mess.
Yeah. Ollie, I think, Ollie, you know what? Try clearing your cookies, John. And then reboot, you know, your page, and that might actually do the job.
Yeah, well, what I've been doing is I've also been going over to Microsoft's browser, which has nothing on it. I never use it. And trying to use that, but I have the same problem there, too. So, but anyway, go ahead.
I mean, you know what? There's a lot of things going on with the Internet today that, I mean, you find, like, applications just opening up on your phone, you know, randomly without your permission. You know, all of a sudden Google is asking you to repeat something that you said because they didn't quite get what you said. They're like, wait, I didn't understand what you just said. I'm like, that's because I didn't say anything to you, Google.
Yeah.
You know. But
all right, well, go ahead. What's your question or comment?
Well, respectfully, I'd like to address the issue of common law grand juries from a power base bottom up kind of positioning, and I was wondering if you were familiar with any of the de facto characteristics of the current state and federal government. And if you could explain a little bit to me and to everyone on the call about how it's possible for us to come in as people, as the people, and fill vacant offices of the de facto government.
Well, we're not going to fill their offices. What we're doing is not an office per se.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a job. The requirement, for doing these things really should be up to the people. You can't have political individuals. It's become clear. You can't have the judge control a courtroom, okay? The tribunal must control the courtroom. The tribunal cannot control that courtroom if it doesn't understand its powers and authorities. And clearly the judges are not teaching and laying out and orientating these people, or no one is doing, giving some orientation for them to understand their power and authority as the people, that they are the law. They're the final statement in that case, and they have the power to nullify. And they don't have to follow any kind of statutes or any of that stupid stuff. They can just throw it all out because no case is really should be ever controlled by statutes. It's got to be controlled by what's going on. It's all by the facts. What happened? How can we restore this individual? You know? And it's not about putting people in jail. Let me finish.
Go ahead.
It's not about
putting these people
in jail or any of those things. On the other side of the coin, okay, in order for a crime to be committed, there's got to be an injured party, as we know, okay? And that's one of the key things. And there are a lot of, cases going on where people, there is no injured party and there is no indictment and people do go to jail or they get fined, okay? And this is all controlled by the prosecutor, generally speaking. When a grand jury is called, it's controlled by the prosecutor. After all, he can handle that ham sandwich and get his indictment. And that's a pretty sick statement because these guys do make these statements and it's pretty damn sick to me. It's not up to them to get an indictment. Yeah, they produce their case before the grand jury. But who's orientating that grand jury to understand what their powers, what their authority is, what is a crime?
Exactly,
what is the
John.
Statute? All these things, they're not getting it anywhere.
Exactly. You know what it comes
to? Well, let me just let me finish.
Okay, sure. I was just complimenting you. Yeah.
I just want to finish the whole thing, and then you could talk again. So, we have to really give this information to these people. The judge is not going to do it. Prosecutor is not going to do it. There's nobody in the court system that's going to do it. So the people have got to do it. After all, it's our job. It should have been that way from the beginning. So we're telling them, stop. Don't pull the grand juries together. Don't pull the trial juries together. We will create a four-person team for every court county, for every county. And those people will handle the job to make sure people are orientated properly to understand their powers and authorities and also, give them an understanding of jury nullification to both the grand jury and the trial jury. And any information or any questions they may have, we'll answer them. Someone has to be there to write an indictment on behalf of the grand jury. After all, they're not educated in that area. Writing an indictment is a simple process, but these people are not educated in that area. You got to get the facts and the information. What is it that the grand jury's will is, and then you have to write up on a piece of paper. Someone has to do that. We will do that. Okay, what the will is in a proper form, and then give it back to them to make sure we didn't add any of our own thoughts or concerns in there, that this is their will. And once they agree, change a few words, change a few sentences, whatever it is, okay, form it out the way they want it, because it's the people, it's not us, it's not the administrators that are doing this. This is the jury pool, the grand jury pool in this case. And then submit it for prosecution. But what needs to be also understood is that the grand jury can try to fix the problem. It doesn't necessarily have to send it into the courts. They might be able to work out something between the individuals, get the restitution set up, and if they both parties agree, it's as if a court case had taken place. They sign the papers. It becomes a solid contract with a wherefore kind of clause that would give them, if the person defaulted and didn't do what had to be done, there'd be certain criteria that would take place. But it would be as if there was a court case and an agreement could be made. And again, jail is not the answer. What is wrong with us? We keep putting all these people in jails. You know, there's only a few people that belong in jails. Judges is one of them I can think of. You know, they're the most destructive people in our country. But jail is not the answer. And so clearly they can't do it. Now, by what authority? Of course, we got the authority of the people. We, the people, you know, ordained and established the Constitution. We must have some authority, right? And, on top of that, where did the first grand jury come from? You know, go read the Magna Carta. That's where the first grand jury, that first known grand jury, came from. And they empowered themselves. What happened? They had to deal with a tyrant. What's happening today? We've established ourselves, brought ourselves together. Why? Because we're dealing with tyrants. And we're going after this tyrant judge. And just like they went after the tyrant king. That's what we're doing. We're putting an end to these tyrants. But anyway, I think that's pretty much it. Yeah.
I've been listening to some Charles Stewart lately and talking to Charles. And, the constitutional form of government whereby the grand juries are at the base of the foundation for this constitutional form of government, which is obviously where the people are most powerful, and it's a ground-up operation, everything from the bottom up instead of top-down power structure. Right now what we have is a top-down power structure. I think everyone on the call could probably agree with that, and that by moving the other direction from, starting from the ground up, local autonomy, right? Meaning that you have a certain level of sovereignty to operate at the local level, as either a township, okay, or head of your household. Let's just go back down to the very, very base of the common law, as head of your household. How many times in our supposed common law system have we seen the debasing and the debunking of the head of the household? It happens every single day. And I think a proper recognition of that, will come with a heightened education. So I do appreciate your education. Do you have something on your website which directs people to comprehension for the impact that a claim of the head of household can make?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. Maybe you can
be
a little more clear.
Something for the head of household? Right. Let me give you an example. Under common law, if let's say I was using my father's vehicle, and it was he's the head of the household, or my mother's vehicle, she's the head of the household, right? Ultimately, they would be, if I damaged something belonging to someone else, the head of the household would be responsible for the money damages or whatever, property damages. And This is why we have insurance today. And I believe insurance is a, you know, it's kind of spawned from the common law. And actually it's taken from the head of the household kind of doctrine, if you will, if you forgive me for using such a weak terminology. Let me summarize what I'm saying, John, that the power structure right now is that it's coming from the top down, which is totally 180 from, I believe, what the founding fathers planned for this country, which was a common law, jural society, okay, starting from the ground up, moving forward from the bottom, and that's where the power should be, starting from the heads of the households in every single township, like, for example, Indiana, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, Minnesota, all these places are, you know, have townships. And it's actually been around for a really, really long time in this country, and it's highly overlooked. And I yield the mic on that note.
All right, I'm not too familiar with some of these things you're bringing up, but, you know, going to the head of the household type of thing, I'd have to hear an argument and debate on that. I have no knowledge or reasoning behind why that would be that case. Now, I do agree. Look, parents are responsible for their children. I remember when I was younger, that was the attitude. Parents were responsible for that child. You broke a window and you got caught, you know, your parents were responsible. You know, whatever it is that a child would do, you know, also, you know, even an animal. Goodness, your dog bites someone. You're responsible for that animal. But once you're an adult or an individual, I don't know that the head of the household, you know, would be responsible for every person in that household if they've become adults. If you still have children that are older, maybe over 20, you know, over 18.
It's a liability thing, John.
Well, if you bring yourself together under as a liability and agree, have come to an agreement.
Only if the parent owned the car. You have insurance to protect that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Look at two people that are liable, the guy driving the car and the guy owning the car. And the liability flows downward. Look, somebody has to pay. Now, the guy driving the car, if he did something stupid that a normal person and under the same situation wouldn't do, now he's criminally negligent. He's liable for that. But whoever owns the car, you want to have insurance, because that guy does something stupid, you're absolutely responsible for what the damage that car does. Even though you didn't do it and he did it, they're going to come after the deep pocket. And you shouldn't,
right.
And look, if you have assets and house insurance, you shouldn't need car insurance. People, I mean, I would do it anyway. I wouldn't want to be out there. I wouldn't want to put my house at risk just to drive a car. So it makes sense to have insurance for what that car does. But as far as, you know, going into the household because you're living there, unless there's a direct connection, I don't think you can make an argument. You're if you're an adult and you're over 18, you're responsible for your action. You do something that's criminal, then you're going to be charged criminally. But whoever owns that car, they're going to get stuck with that bill regardless of who you are or what you did. It's going to come back to you because it's your car ultimately.
Another thing on this car insurance thing, you know, that we should come aware of and realize, because something needs to be done here, and it first starts off with education and understanding the problem and then dealing with that problem. Years ago, when I first got my first car, years ago you insured the car. If I gave the keys to someone else and they drove it and they got into an accident, that car's insured. Okay, that whole thing has been turned around, and I don't know when exactly it happened, but I remember, you know, stories of a friend particularly who borrowed his sister's car, was insured, and the insurance wouldn't cover it because they said they're not insuring the car, they're insuring the driver, the individual, and they have to be listed as a driver on that thing. Now, that started a while back, the driver thing, listing the drivers, but then they started moving into, you know, if you loan your car to someone, you know, they're not covering it anymore. Well, here's the question, you know, that we need to be asking ourselves. If you've got two cars, you know, I can understand that, you know, maybe the fact that someone might steal it or something can, you know, get it, someone can hit it while it's parked. So, yeah, you should pay a little more. But your insurance is not that minimum if you have two cars. After all, you can only drive one car at a time. So there's a scam going on here. You know, if it benefits them, they're only insuring the individual. And in the other end, if they have to deal, oh, well, we have to insure the car. You know, well, you got two cars, you know, it's going to cost you double the amount. No, dude, they
right.
do give you a little bit of a discount, but it's nowhere near what it should be.
But okay, my point is this, John, is that what ends up happening, you guys, and I will close with this and I will yield the mic, okay, so we can move forward, that is this, that when there is the absence of the claim of the common law at the township level being the head of the household, okay, and as you know, 10 townships make up a precinct, okay, and in San Francisco there's over 600 precincts. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but when you make that claim at the local level, you literally have the ability to trump these de facto military court justifications of being able to just come in over your doings, you know, and issue out a punishment. And so this is one of the reasons why insurance is such a curio of law, if you will. And I yield with that.
Yeah. No. Sure,
you wanted to say something?
Yeah. What they did, I don't know when they did it, but it was probably 20, 25 years ago. They instituted what they called no fault. And with no fault, each car pays its own injuries, because what was happening, people would get hit and then nobody would get paid until you had a lawsuit and figured out who was at fault. Meanwhile, all these bills are piling up. So under no fault, any injuries received in your car, your insurance company pays for. Any injuries in the other car, their insurance pays for. But that only pays for that. It doesn't pay for property damage. It doesn't pay for law, you know, anything else that you could sue for. It just gets you out of the hospital, basically. And then they have a part called uninsured motorists, where if the other guy had no insurance, now your insurance pays everything, because that's uninsured motorists, personal injury protection uninsured. And they had to do it because they had all these different crazy things. And, you know, that's one of the reasons
right. That
they don't like common law, because you got to sift through all – it almost is like common law if you think about it, because you got to flush through this thing and figure out who's what and what's what. It's much easier to go to statute and say, this is what the statute says. You did this, that. That's outside the statute. They love that because it makes the deliberations much shorter, much easier, and they don't have to take into consideration the human factor of where. Now,
right.
You know, my wife had jury duty today, and one of the instructions that the judge gave was, look, you guys get to decide guilt or innocence. I will decide the sentence, and my decision will be based on the law. Your decision will be based on guilt or innocence. But you see, when he says that, what he's doing is he's taking away their ability to decide on the law, whether the law is being misapplied or they don't like the law. They don't even instruct them on that. They don't tell them, if you don't like this law, you know what I mean? And even though you might think that he's guilty, you could say innocent, because you know, the judge says, you're going to decide on guilt or innocence of the law that I give you. So he's taken away a decision of theirs on the law. So anyway, I just wanted to say
think that. I appreciate what you're saying here, but I think a healthy recognition of the differences between the de facto rulings that come out of these courts and the de jure ones, which are actually implemented by rules of court, by local community customs, okay, that come from local community customs. I mean, we still have this tradition today. It's just being forgotten about, and we need to furthermore implement. And that's all for now. I appreciate the time today, you guys.
All right. Thanks, Jeremiah. You know, before we end this call, I want to make one other point concerning insurance. And it's another thing that people need to think about, because we need to do something about this at some point in time. You know, I have no credit. I don't want credit. I haven't had credit in over 20 years. I used to have credit cards and all that junk, but I don't have it. If I don't have the money, I'm not getting it. But in any event, I have no credit. So I have insurance. I've been with my insurance company for quite some time, and I generally pay, you know, every 6 months I'll pay the insurance. Sometimes if I can, I'll pay the whole year at one shot. My insurance full coverage on my vehicle is about $1,100 a year, Okay. And I've gotten calls from other insurance companies, you know, soliciting me, telling me that they're going to give me a better deal, save me, you know, hundreds, perhaps even $1,000 on my insurance. And I've tried these things over the year, a couple of them. Geico is one of the biggest ones, okay, went to Geico. And after they evaluated, got some information for me and evaluated the situation, you know, I get the call or and they say, okay, I got a good deal for you. We can give you your insurance, full coverage, this, that, and the other thing. And of course, it's only going to cost you $2,800 a month. I would tell them, what are you, crazy? I'm paying $1,100 a month. Why would you come to me, soliciting me, telling me you're going to give me a better deal than what I got, and you don't even know what I got, and then you're more than twice the amount of my insurance company? How could you go about doing that? And they said, well, you don't have any credit. Well, what does that have to do with insurance? Of course, they want to make sure they get paid and you pay the premium, you know. But if you're going to pay the premium up front, you know, you pay 6 months, you paid the premium up front to begin with anyway. But even with that, how do they justify that idea of doubling your insurance because you don't have credit, you know? Same problem with these cell phones, you know, these track phones. Again, you're paying up ahead of time. Why do you pay much more per call or per minute or however that works? At least that's the way it used to be. I don't know how it works now, but I know it was minutes, and it was ridiculous the amount of money that people would have to pay for these track phones per minute when they're paying in advance. You know, it, again, taking advantage of people because maybe they don't have credit or they're poor or whatever the case may be. But it's a major problem with these insurance companies. Just wanted to bring that to light. Okay, let's take our next caller. Let's see. Hopefully this is going to work. It looks like Ollie's already unmuted. Ollie, you there from Colorado?
Hello.
Yeah, go right ahead,
here.
Ollie.
Okay.
Hello, yeah. Ollie. Can't hear you, Ollie.
Hello. Hello.
Hello, hello, can't hear you.
Okay, my announcement.
But go ahead anyway.
Okay. Hey, it started today out in Vegas. I didn't expect it so soon. They had something like a pretrial hearing. Okay, the first thing, David Sleeman had put a live video up on Facebook this afternoon. He is the one that hauls all the stuff in early in the morning and sets up the demonstration down on the sidewalk. Okay, the first thing they discovered was they put a lot more restrictions on the protesters. They gave them about a 2-foot strip down at the foot of the steps. They can't be on the sidewalk. They can't go on the stairs, the steps up to the upper platform. They can't go on the upper platform. They can't even not even go in the courthouse, or they will be arrested for trespassing. Okay, now Andrea Parker put up a live video, and for those that don't know, her husband is one of the P3s that went through the first trial and going through the second one again. That pretrial hearing, Navarro didn't even show up, but she denied all the defense's motions. They're totally restricting the defense more and more and more. Forget about due process. The defense, they have no traction. They have no defense whatsoever. Okay. Now, two of the key players out in Las Vegas is Larry Klayman and Roger Stone. Okay, Larry Klayman, I think his website is Freedom Outpost. He's a very good attorney. He tried to apply to be Clive and Bundy's attorney. They started shaking, and they totally denied him. He would tear that courthouse up. Now, the other one is Roger Stone. Now, they both have sort of political jobs. They both have sort of a communication inroad or communication deal into the political process. They both claim to have that into the White House. Okay. And they both, they are using the Bundys and the Finicums, Lavoie Finicum, as a bugle cry, okay, to rally around them. And they're going to have a dinner out there, I think the 15th. Okay, Roger Stone is going to speak at that dinner. Adam Kokesh, which is another, he's a veteran, another veteran protester. Deb Jordan, Jeanette Finicum, Michelle Fiore, they're going to have some good speakers there. Okay, now, there are two people out there that belong to NLA, and I've been trying to get a hold of them for 2 weeks. When I try to call them, they don't answer, and I keep losing their phone numbers, and you know how that goes. But anyway, court observers, we desperately need affidavits. I PM'd Andrea Parker today, you know, about what they're doing to the demonstrators now. We need affidavits. We need affidavits. Well, it's the same thing. But there's somebody out there, trolls on Facebook, and active people out there, and I've got my suspicions who they are, that have badmouthed the NLA, they badmouthed people's grand juries. Because when you're on the right track, when you're on target, you get attacked. We need to get affidavits coming out. We need affidavits this time. I wish Tom Sewell was down there. I'd be getting at least one a week. But I'm just trying to put out a call for maybe some help or just let everybody become aware of the fact that it is starting out in Vegas again.
Did you talk with the committee leader of our courtroom observers?
No, I haven't. In fact, I used to go on that.
Get a hold of them and get a hold of Jen. Ask Jen to get the word out to help, and to talk or to meet up with the committee leader and get a word out for that area looking for courtroom observers.
What's her name? What was her name? Lou? Is she still involved with that? What was her name?
Jen, who's running that? Do you know?
It was Laura.
Laura.
Yeah.
And right now, Robert Bristow's in charge of it, and we have Terry from New Jersey, too, working on it.
So can
and that's
with
why,
that?
I, that's why that? I say I'm looking for a leader for a new leader for courtroom observers. But, we'll work with you, Ollie.
Yeah. I'm too old. I went out there 2 months ago, and I got hot and cramped, and I couldn't walk for 2 days. I just can't take it anymore. But if I was out there for a month, get settled in and all that, I could go gangbusters and maybe do something. But I'm trying to do everything remote right now. And yeah, Robert, we need to get a hold of that Stacy Benner down there. She's a member of the NLA, and she is very familiar with the situation down there. In fact, her and her husband is one that rented that house for all the P3 families down there in that little town south of Vegas, Benson or whatever it is. But
I'll get a hold of you. I'll get a hold of you tomorrow, Ollie, and we'll set something up.
Yeah. We sure need to get something going down there.
We will.
It breaks my heart, just like when they beat Almond up in Paul Rump. It just tore me up that I couldn't get no affidavits out of that. I cried. I was in tears. But, you know, here's the thing, Robert. Things are falling in place in D.C. All the pieces of the puzzle are gradually falling in place. There is a divine plan, and I can see that divine plan unfolding. But Mother Nature, God is slow. Everything has to be timed just right, and everything has to be perfect for it to work. And we get impatient and all this and that. But, get with me tomorrow, Robert, and maybe we can get something going down there. If I can't afford it, I wouldn't be able to afford it this month, and it'd be 3 weeks before I could get out there. But let's try to get something going tomorrow, Robert.
All right, so you guys connect and do what you could do.
Yeah, we'll get it done.
Okay, thanks. I yield.
Thanks, Ollie. All right, well, let me, I'd like to reiterate an announcement I made a little earlier. I was skimming down to see, you know, some people came in late, you know, especially the people on the West Coast, because we start at 9 p.m. Eastern time, and that's 6 p.m. on the west side of the nation here. And so sometimes some of these people can't get on till 7 o'clock. Maybe they're coming home from work, they're eating dinner, and they get on late. So I just want to reiterate the announcement I made a little earlier. Tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here in this room, same room number, same code to get in, we're going to be considering an indictment. We'd like to get as many people together as possible to sit on this grand jury. Last few times we went through this kind of thing, we had hundreds of people. I'd hoped that we'd get hundreds of people again, but we want to get as many as we can. And in order to be prepared for what we're going to be discussing, you're going to want to go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on highlight grand jury and click on docket. And you're going to want to read two papers. They're paper number 1024. It's an unlawful order to dismiss by some judge who just, you know, announced himself king and came into the courtroom and made a decision. So, anyway, we had read, I'm not sure whether we read that paper, but we have posted it. We wrote a writ of error, which is 1024-01. So the first one is 1024, unlawful order to dismiss. Second one is 1024-01, writ of error, final. That word final probably doesn't belong there. This was the final writing. But anyway, those two papers you want to read, and that's what you're going to be considering the indictment on. And we will list out, it's already listed in the writ of error, what laws this individual has broken, this judge. And we'll see what happens after tomorrow. I think, and you know, we're going to kind of build a little position concerning this. Anybody wants to make any comments before we actually make a decision? Maybe someone would like to give a position from to not indict. I don't know, but we'll have people talking. You know, but we're not going to spend much time. People need to be prepared by reading these two documents, contemplating over them, and make a decision what they feel concerning indictment. And then we'll take a vote. It should be a short meeting. I'm kind of thinking 15 minutes. We've done this before on a state level a couple of years back, so we do have a couple of indictments that's been sitting around that we're going to resurrect eventually, but, you know, it was way too early, way too premature. I think the timing of this is right now. This will also put some heat on the magistrate of the courtroom. Because he's been awfully quiet about all this.
Okay, call Matt in a question, please.
So, yeah, I'm sorry, I've got to do some kind of a coughing bout here. All right, but anyway, people need to read those two papers in order to make a decision. If you come to the room and you haven't read the papers, you're going to be asked to leave and not participate in the vote. But go ahead, Ollie, you want to say something again?
Yes, this indictment, I feel that this indictment is at exactly the right time. Now, I've got a question about that, but anyway, if this indictment, if we get any traction out of this indictment at all, we will put pressure, we will make a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
In Vegas and all over. So my question is this, if we do an indictment tomorrow, can I go public with that and maybe start getting some more people interested in doing our affidavits out there in Vegas?
Well, absolutely. But, you know, look, at people who are following along and really following along and really reading the papers and understanding what it is we're doing, where we started from, where we're at, where we're trying to get to, and I think we're very close to where we're trying to get to, you know, we need an indictment that sticks. An indictment that really we can get the prosecutors involved with us, prosecutors
yes.
who will come in and obey the common law process. And once we get to that point, then it's a winner, slam dunk. We're going to move very quickly across this nation dealing with all kinds of problems because we'll have that first one under our belt and we'll have the authority, the prosecutors, and trial going on. one of the other problems is you get the people who just don't have the patience. This is an uphill battle, and if people can't understand that, then they get frustrated, and they might even say, these people, they're not getting anywhere, they're not doing nothing. But they don't understand what's really going on here. We do need critical mass, and or we need the president along with Jeff Sessions working with us. If we can get Jeff Sessions to send us some prosecutors and the president putting the pressure on Jeff Sessions to do that, okay, if we can get that happening, then that'll cause critical mass very quickly. It'll give empowerment to the common law grand juries. A lot of things will change across this nation very quickly. If we can't push that quick enough, then we're still waiting for critical mass. Critical mass is the other side of this thing. You see, if the people in power don't do it, the people themselves will do it. And we're still building. We're constantly adding membership. We're building and building and building, and at some point we're going to hit that critical mass. So one way or the other, it's going to happen. But we need people with patience to understand the problem. Look, there is no other answer out there that I'm aware of. Even with President Trump, let's say President Trump makes America great again, okay? Everybody all of a sudden starts to behave themselves to some degree. Well, let's say he does 8 years. Once he's gone, then what? You see, we go right back to the same old, same old. It'll take longer maybe for them to get back to where they were, but nevertheless, you're back to the same thing over and over again. The only way to save this nation and fix it is the people. The people must do it. Only the people can save America. They have to step up, they have to stand up, and they got to do it. They got to take control. And this is what we're trying to do, to leverage the people at the grassroots level in every county to take control of their grand juries and trial juries through administrations, both on the state and federal levels. And we've got all of the necessary information to do this up on our website. We've got all the training and everything up there, and we're working on a booklet also, sort of a handbook for administrators. So that eventually will get done also. But anyway, that's where we're at. Yes, if we can get the indictment and get things moving, then yeah. And of course, we do want this. We do want this information out there. And if you're going to share an indictment, you need to share the two papers with it. What this indictment is about. What this guy did and what the people did. Go ahead.
I have a question regarding this subject. Do we have anybody that a reporter? I'm just thinking if we have somebody that can be a reporter and take notes on and write a story on the Monday night call, and especially when there's information that's being put out like tonight, you know, write up a story and get it to Ollie to be posted in the NLA News that next morning.
Well, we do have bloggers that they can get a hold of Ollie and me if they want. They get a hold of Jan, and Jan can set up an interview with me or with Gerard. They can work off the information, again, on this on tonight's call. And then they can write their story and get all the necessary paperwork. But let us be fair here. We don't know whether we're going to get an indictment or not.
Well, it doesn't matter.
We're not going to know that till tomorrow.
The fact that you're writing that indictment, that's news.
Correct.
Exactly. To me, this is the biggest.
Right, but an indictment doesn't become news until it becomes an indictment. Just remember that. You know, when a grand jury is coming together listening to cases, they surely should not be speaking to news. They shouldn't be letting any information leak out to the general public. They should be keeping it private, because once they look at things, they may decide, nothing here, we're not going to indict. Where people get the wrong idea and they say, oh, look, these people did wrong, they're this, they're that, and next thing, and they didn't get indicted. So we have to keep it sort of, we can't go into a news move at this point. But after tomorrow's meeting, if there's no indictment, then there's no news story. If there is an indictment, then there is a news story. So, and I agree. Let's try to find someone, you know.
Well, I think it would be good if we had somebody that was designated reporter, or two or three of them.
we do have a couple of people, and they can all write they're from their own perspective. They can get together and write whatever they want to do. Jan, get the word out to them. I don't know if they're on a call tonight, but I know we have a couple of bloggers that will hopefully write something for us.
Okay, one other thing. Andrea and another guy was talking, I can't remember his name. I met him when I was out there. I can't remember his name. They're standing there talking about their clamping down on the demonstrators. And she said, well, she said, they don't want a bunch of us out here because Sessions is going to be in town. He's going to be out here talking about sanctuary cities. And I didn't know Las Vegas was a sanctuary city, but I find it odd that Sessions might be in Las Vegas at any time during this trial. I mean, the things are happening. Things are happening for a reason. There is a divine plan. And it might get interesting here, you know. Well, it's very interesting right now, but there's some things that might be going down in these next few weeks. But
story that needs to be written.
Exactly, I'm chomping at the bit. I'm ready to go. Just give me some news, and I'll with my. Rebels with my southern accent and everything else, I'll get on the news and I'll read it.
Okay, we're going to move on to our next caller. Before we do this, I'm going to reiterate again, really I'm going to talk to Jan and through that reiterate what we're doing here, because I want people to get this message. Maybe people are just joining us now, maybe people are away not listening, but we want to get it out to our entire membership. Jan, make sure you keep this short. Get it out into the news blast. We need to do it tonight so people have time. And make sure you include the location of the two papers that they need to read. Make sure they understand the two papers that are required to read and that they're coming in for the sole purpose to sit, listen, and cast a vote, guilty or, you know, whether indict or don't indict. And make sure they understand, you know, how to get into the room. Don't send them to the Monday Night Call page. You know, to say this is, you give them the phone number, give them the access code and the time, make it clear it's Eastern Standard Time, and that they're coming in as a grand jurist to cast a vote. It's nobody's name is going to be taken or anything in this thing. It's completely anonymous. And we're just going to make a count of all the people involved in the process. And, you know, over 50%. It's indictment, period. Okay, let's move to the next caller. Jan, you got all that?
Surely do.
Thank you. Keep it simple, okay, but very detailed. All right. Rhonda from Indiana, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Rhonda. I am trying to get my grandkids, but I was turned to your guys' organization through a gentleman by the name of Michael Anthony. He's a watchdog. And he said you guys might be able to help me, point me in the right direction to what I need to do because of the courts denying me and falsely saying things that are not true.
All right, so you're trying to get your grandchildren? What's up with the parents?
They illegally went into my daughter's home and took my grandchildren from my daughter. And they've made up a lot of false accusations on my daughter as well. And right now she's in hiding, and we're trying to keep the children she's got right now from them finding them.
Yeah, you know, look, there is a major problem. You know, family situations should be kept to the family. If there is a problem in a household and it does become necessary to possibly do something about it, the children should be able to go to stay with family and not taken to be going with strangers. But this whole system is set up in a wrong way. I know, you know, my sister was in the service, this is many, many years ago, and she was married and her husband was abusing the children. She found out about it. By the time she got home, the kids were taken. And they took it away from both of them, and she couldn't get them. I tried to intervene to get them, and they wouldn't even talk to me. And so they don't look at extended families at all, and that's a shame. But we could do something potentially. We're not doing habeas corpuses right now, but maybe we can find time to help. Why don't you get a hold of Jan, and you can get him his phone number up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and go to the directory, get Jan's phone number, and give Jan a call, explain the case to him, and if he thinks it's something we might be able to take on and do a habeas corpus for, I'd love to get back to doing habeas corpuses. We're looking for people who will assist us in this, but in any event, maybe we could do at least one more. But talk with Jan, and let's see what's going on, give the details to him, and then if he thinks there's something we could do, he'll bring it to me, and we'll discuss it, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, because right now I've got a lot of pictures of the abuse that my grandchildren are going through, because I do get to see them along with my daughter. And that's mm-hmm. why I found this gentleman on one of the...
What kind of abuse?
They've got black and blue marks. One of them's had a broken arm. They're trying to cover that up. Medical neglect. I mean, we've got a whole list of stuff within the last 2 years of what they have been doing.
Get your affidavits. Write all this stuff down and make it turn into an affidavit. Talk with Jan. Talk with Jan tomorrow or the next day, whenever you get, when you two can connect, and let's see where we go from there. Okay?
Okay,
John.
I appreciate it.
Yeah,
thank
John.
You.
I talked to her this afternoon and suggested that she file an affidavit, and I emailed her the exact location on the website to go to get the affidavit form and so on. So we're well on the way. I'm assured.
So we want a lot of details of facts on or about, if you don't have no exact dates and times. And don't get lost in the law. Don't get lost in trying the case. Just tell us the story. That's all we want to know. From there, we'll take it to the law side.
Okay. I can most definitely do that.
All right. We'll see what we can do. We'll try to do something. But let's look at exactly what's going on first before we want to make a decision. Okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay. We'll take our next caller. Yeah. Before we do so, I just want to let everyone go ahead.
Yeah, John. Just wondering, between now, 10:30, 11 o'clock, and tomorrow evening is pretty short. We do have a Thursday night call scheduled normally anyway at 9. Could we maybe do Thursday night for the indictment rather than tomorrow? Give people a chance to get in.
Why don't we do Wednesday? Can we do Wednesday?
Well, that's tomorrow, yeah.
No, tomorrow's Tuesday.
Oh, excuse me. This is Monday. Okay, yeah.
Okay, so let's change that to Wednesday, okay?
Yeah.
And let's correct that for everyone that's here. I know some people have left and they think it's going to be Tuesday. And, you know, well, someone will be in the room Tuesday to let them know anyway. The Tuesday room will be on, right?
Yeah, we don't have a normal Tuesday room.
We don't have nobody in the room at 9 o'clock on Tuesday?
No, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Mondays.
Okay. All right, well, maybe we'll have to sit in there for 5-10 minutes. But, well, look, we're going to get the email out so people will get the information. But you're right, let's give them an extra day. So we'll set for, we're going to set up for Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for a considered indictment. Okay,
yep.
That'll give people an extra day. All right, that's good. I'm good.
Good.
By the way, if anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6, if you have a question or a comment, there's only a couple of people, at least I only see a couple of people on my board. Is there only a couple of people in the queue right now, Jan?
Right. There's just one more.
All right. If anybody's got a comment or a question, let's star 6 to get in.
Hey,
go to the next person.
I think Brent is here, too.
Did he show up? Oh, Brent, how you doing? Let's take this person here, and then Brent, if you want to spend a little time talking, we'll pass the mic over to you. So, but anyway, 973, you've been unmuted.
Hi, John. It's Terry in New Jersey.
How you doing? What was your first name in Jersey?
Terry.
Terry. Go ahead, Terry.
I was wondering if you were familiar with this thing called the Stamp Stampede. That was it was a grassroots campaign started by Ben and Jerry of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream. And what they were doing is they had a campaign to try to get money out of politics. And what they would do is they would stamp the money with their campaign. And I thought maybe that might be an idea for the NLA, if they could come up with a stamp, and people would just, if they could start stamping their money, because it says here, the campaign concluded that every dollar bill is seen by an average of 875 people, meaning that if 100 people stamp $10 a day for a year, the messages would reach over 300 million people. And actually, they have all the legal, they've done all the legal vetting on this already. And although there is a statute that prohibits people from defacing U.S. currency, it's effectively unenforceable because it's your money and you can put your message on it.
Nobody would know who did it anyway, so.
Exactly. And the other thing is, you could actually make money with this if you sold the stamps.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, and what was the cause? Again, they were looking to get the money out of politics from the standpoint of dealing with the special interest groups. Is that what it's about?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what it was about.
Well, we intend on ending that once we get into the courts, because that's nothing more than fraud. That's payoff. You know, look at people have elected individuals to go to Washington to represent them, or they elected individuals to go to their state capital to represent them. And when some special interest groups gets in and gives money to an individual that is in power, that is a legislator, in order to influence them in legislation that may not particularly benefit the constituency, okay, that's a sellout, and they're not doing their job, and that's a wrongdoing, no matter how you go about doing it. Look, if someone is going to support, let's say I was an elected individual, and someone wanted to support me because they believe in what I'm doing, well, that's one thing. But if you're going to come and influence me on legislation, and give me some money and influence me to take my vote, to move my vote in order to support something that's going to benefit you usually economically, you know, with money, that's a crime. That, as far as I'm concerned. That needs to stop.
What Terry's talking about, though, is taking that idea and using it for our cause, that we could make stamps for our own cause and put it on dollar bills. And if 1,000 of us did it over a quarter, would you say a year, that you could reach 300 million people? I think that's a great idea.
Well, it is a great idea, but we're not going. We're not what? Good.
You just got to figure what catchy thing to put on the stamp that would.
Well, I think that's what people need to think about. We don't want to really move that from a national level as a campaign, because, you know, that makes us a target. So we're not going to push that kind of an idea. It's an interesting idea. People will do what they want to do, though. That's their business. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. So whatever people want to do, people can do.
Okay.
Anything else, Terry? Well, we've got to be a little careful here, Gerard.
Was it the insurance company say you had no credit or no credibility?
Yeah. Well, I got to go look back at my notes on that one. You know?
Yeah. Okay.
Anything else, Terry?
No, that's it.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, let us go to Brent. Do you want to take the mic for a while? *6 to unmute yourself, because you're muted. If you're talking, you're talking to yourself alone. All right, maybe he's away from the computer. Okay, let's take the next caller anyway. See if my button works. Ed from Oklahoma, you got the mic.
How you doing? This is Ed from Duncan, Oklahoma.
How you doing?
I'm doing great, John.
Good.
First off, I want to thank all of you guys. It's inspiring to be part of your team, and I just came back on board a few months ago, and in talking with Robert, we just happened to be talking about herbs and stuff like that, and he actually created the website for Natural Healing, made me the director of it. So I'm kind of real proud to be part of that committee. And but most importantly, it's I don't really have a question. I just want to make a statement that it's so inspiring to know that we had that we're moving forward, and there's so much happening that's on a good level, even though that we have all this bad stuff happening, you know, around us. But it's just it's exciting to be on these calls and hearing everybody coming together and uniting, and hopefully we'll just hit that critical mass that you keep on talking about very quickly. But I just wanted to thank all you guys for your commitment, I'm excited about making this all work. Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate that.
Okay, thank you, Ed. We appreciate your comments. Thank you. And anybody wants to get into the queue, star six. Brent, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Yes.
So you want to take take a few minutes and talk to us?
Sure. That, I appreciate it. Thanks. And,
okay. This is Brent Winters, the author of Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, go right ahead. And then we'll go back to the Q&A as soon as Brent's done.
Yeah, well, thanks, John. We left off last time talking about over in the Declaration of 76. We've been going through it, clause by clause and blow by blow. We're in paragraph 2. We just finished talking about the long train of abuses and usurpation pursuing invariably the same object. And the Declaration says this evinces, that means it proves, a design to reduce these colonies, them, under absolute despotism. And it says it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government, provide new guards for their future security. We talked about that, but then the next sentence says this: such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies. Such, S-U-C-H, that means the putting up with the absolute or the long train of abuse and usurpation. That's what he's referring to here when he says such. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies. And such is now the necessity which constrains them, that means which forces them, to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He calls him the King of Great Britain, and indeed he called himself the King of Great Britain, but it ought to be said often that King George did not call himself the King of the American colonies. Indeed, he always called himself, and this by law, it wasn't just him saying it, everybody in England believed it. He didn't call himself king, he called himself emperor. And he was emperor, which makes sense. It was the British Empire, and empires don't have kings. They have emperors. And he was king on the Isle of Britain, but he was emperor over all other land of which Britain controlled throughout the world, in the Far East and in the West. And the people in other parts of the world, other continents, they didn't know the difference. They wouldn't have known the difference between an emperorship and a kingship. Especially they didn't even know the English language. They had their own language. So they didn't understand that. But here in America, the people that were here considered themselves British. In fact, they had ties, as our Declaration of 76 says, of consanguinity. That means they were sanguis means blood. They had common blood. They were British too. They were cousins. And they weren't willing to tolerate being treated like the Oriental people on the other side of the world. And that was the fact of the matter. That's what the way they felt about it. They said, we're British. We're not Chinese. We're not Indian. We're not Pakistani. We're British. We're entitled to everything that you've got. And they didn't agree, or if they ended up going to war. Now, it says here, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. That's very important. That is a chief feature of our common law government, that we have public trials. That means in front of a candid world. Candid, that means, you remember with Alan Funt, was his name Funt or Fudd? I don't remember, but I think it was Funt. He hosted a television show called Candid Camera, and it was immensely popular for a long time. It had to do with things being, cameras being held in secret, and nobody knew they were being photographed or filmed. That's the word I'm looking for. But here the word is used to bespeak being absolutely open. But to stress this more, the chief feature of our common law is public. Things are done in public. And if things are done in public, they're put in our courts to words. They are oral. Our trials, a public trial, by definition of our common law, is an oral trial. Because if it's oral, then other people can come and watch and listen and make their own judgments about it. They can decide whether or not things were done properly, whether or not due process was followed. I hear you talk on these calls about court observers. Well, that's a right that people have to come in and watch the proceedings of government. And if things are not oral, they're in writing. And in the rest of the world, all the rest of the world, there are not trials, there are inquisitions. That's what they call them, and that's what they are. That means you just ask questions, but it gets a lot worse than that. An inquisition is where you ask questions of people, and they give you the answers you want, or you make life miserable for them. And that's called torture. And the rack, and all those things we've heard about in Europe, the inquisitions in Spain, etc. There was a famous book issued in Europe back in those days, the days of just before a century before the beginning of our country. And I forget the Latin name. It had the word malice in it. Malice, which is a Latin word for mallet. We say mallet. It means hammer. And the title of the book was Hammer of Witches. Hammer of Witches. And it was an instruction book. You can probably find it on the internet still. An instruction book that issued from the Roman Pope of how to hammer witches, how to find them. And over 100,000 witches or accused witches and warlocks were executed on the continent of Europe. That's what we have records of, 100,000. And most people believe it was more like 300,000. That's a lot of people to execute as witches. Now, this is the law of the city. This is contrary to our common law, the law of the land. In England, there were about 300, just 300 by comparison to well over 100,000. That's a conservative number on the continent of Europe. And in England, 300 were burned as witches. In the American colonies, in New England, 9, if I have my numbers right, I think 9. The madness spilled over. Every ship that came from Europe carried news of the madness of Europe. Amazing. It's rather amazing that it was not only 300 in England, but 9 here, and it was a traumatic experience. But isn't it funny, in the way of curious, that the only witch burning we ever hear of is what occurred in the American colonies, the Salem witch trials, popular all over the world. This was the great travesty. While in Europe, there were well over 100,000, in England, 300. But that's the way the evil empire works. It's like us being accused of abusing privileges with slavery. There was slavery in America, but only 9% of the slaves in the New World were in the American colonies and later become American states. 9%. The majority of them were in the Caribbean and in Central America. And South America, some, the northern parts of South America, but the Caribbean was the big place. And that wasn't, we weren't in control of all those islands. But we got abused, and not abused, we got accused of being the greatest trespassers upon the rights of other men through slavery. And, of course, any slavery is wrong. But we weren't the biggest problem. History seldom tells the truth. The popular history seldom ever tells the truth. Well, the other thing about slavery, and this has to do with the common law versus the civil law, because in the countries where the law of the city prevails, slavery is part of the system. Roman civil law, the law of the city, all over the world, and today. There's more slavery in the world, from what I can read. I've looked at it a little bit, more slavery in the world per capita than there ever has been in the history of the world. Islamic slavery has always gone hand in hand with Roman slavery. And they had a regular racket going for centuries with the Islamic people in northern Africa receiving the slaves that were harvested north of what was the Roman Empire up into the Germanic and Hungarian states. So much so that, oh, it's an incredible story. But there were just as many white slaves in the Caribbean at one time as there were black. That's the other fact of history that has been written out of the history books. As a matter of fact, the word redneck, it was a word coined by the black slaves in the Caribbean to make fun of the white slaves with whom they worked in the cane fields and other kinds of fields, molasses mostly down there, I suppose. But the rednecks were the slaves that came over from Europe, mostly from Britain, that were starving, and they sold themselves in slavery. Well, such has been the patient sufferance, paragraph 2 of these colonies, and such is the necessity now which constrains them to alter their systems of government. And this is, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world, and here we get into the meat, the body of the Declaration of 76. The phrase absolute tyranny used in this clause and absolute despotism used in the previous clause, those both mean enslavement. The word absolute means run amok. And despotism, run amok, and tyranny, run amok. Why do I say that? Well, these are old Latin words. Absolute means dissolved from. Dissolve means to loosen completely. And that's what absolute means. It means loosen completely. Despotism, turn loose. Used in previous clause, enslavement. Much of our Declaration's language is taken from the First Continental Congress's first meeting on the 14th of October, 1774, resolving that, and they did this at the meeting, they resolved that the acts of King and Parliament, and I'm quoting, demonstrate a system formed to enslave America. That's what they said in 1774. So what he's saying, what we have said, we're Americans, we have said in our Declaration of 76, we have said here in this clause is a repeat, and just a little bit different words, of what our first Congress said back in October of 1774. So unlike the law of the city, which governs almost every country in the world under the Code of Justinian, the Roman civil law, the law of the Roman Empire, put to code by the Emperor Justinian in the 5th century, or about 500 AD, unlike that system, which elevates law, that means its code, the Roman code, statute code, elevates it over facts, our Declaration of 76 is a common law document because we're a common law country, have been since before the Declaration was written. And in a common law tradition like our own, facts govern everything. Law does not come first. Facts come first. If law comes first, and this is scholasticism, this is intellectualism, this is the university systems of the world that have been around since 1053 AD. They elevate, and they call it scholasticism, that was what was called for years, and the scholastics of the church became very popular. Men like St. Thomas Aquinas, of course he wasn't any more of a saint than you or I, but that's what they call him, Tom Aquinas. He was the chief scholastic, and he elevated, very smart man. His logic was impeccable. They worshipped logic. When you do that, facts have a way of receiving from consideration, and people focus on reason. And they think that's the all that ends all, and that's what the law of the city is all about. It's very elegant, very balanced, very pretty. Their inquisitions are very orderly. The trouble is they never find the truth, the fact. Because you can't find the truth of facts, says our common law, without a fight. That's just the way it is. Because truth, as Paul the Apostle puts it, Romans chapter 1, along there about verse 16, 17, 18, right in there. He says truth, maybe a little 20, maybe verse 20, right there somewhere. He says truth is buried in under unrighteousness. People hide the truth by nature. because the truth is not pleasant. Who's really going to tell the truth about themselves? Who's going to tell everything that's bad with everything that's good? I have someone in my family that did a genealogical study, and I went around and talked to different people in the family and tried to gather information, go to all the tombstones and the graveyards. I did an excellent job. But my father always said he didn't want to look at his family tree because he's afraid he'd get out on a limb someplace of the tree and find a rope and somebody hanging from it, which undoubtedly would be true. But you read these genealogical histories that men write that are not the Bible or something. Well, obviously they're not the Bible. And they're nice. They tell a lot of good information, but they never say anything bad about it, the fact. Why? Because men don't want to talk about that. And you don't blame them. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying the fact. Truth is not always pretty. It's often offensive. And even when it's the truth of God's law, for instance, the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, it's harsh. It scares people. They don't want to talk about it. So that's why Paul says it's buried. And we in our common law tradition know that. We accept that. And we say the way to get the truth to bob forth from the flux of human relationships is by trial, is by the crucible, as our courtrooms are sometimes called, because we really go into court and we conduct battle by trial instead of trial by battle. But it's a battle, and we fight. They do not do that in France and Germany and South America and Vietnam and Russia. They don't fight, do it. You just go in. You answer questions of the judge, the inquisitor, and hope you give him the answers he wants. Elsewise, you may get yourself attached electrodes or something to get the answers they want to make sure the state is vindicated. That's the chief principle of the law of the city. Well, for 166 years before our Declaration of 76, Parliament had left their American colonies alone. 166 years. No interference. The reason there was no interference, because George I, grandfather to George III, George II, father to George III, were more interested in German beer and German girls than they were being king, but they had a way of always showing up on payday, and they didn't pay any back in England, that is. They were Germans. They were German princes, amazingly, and they didn't pay any attention to the American colonies for 166 years, left them alone, and that is why we had so much freedom in the colonies. They were so prosperous. And when King George III tried to turn that around, he was really an orderly man, a man who believed in law. He had a large family, 10 children. He promoted agriculture like no king in England had ever done before. He loved to make a big garden every year, and he did. He was unlike his father and his grandfather. He wasn't a philanderer. He wasn't... He probably enjoyed beer. I don't know if he enjoyed it the way they did, and girls, but he was a pretty good guy. And this is the amazing thing, and this is something we need to watch for. He was a tyrant. What is a tyrant? He's a man who might be a pretty good guy on the surface and really doesn't understand that he's a tyrant, but he becomes one. That's what happens to men. And he was under pressure from Parliament. Of course, he was wealthy like them, and he was deeply invested in the Bank of London and the trading arm of the bank, the British East India Company. And he was under pressure then from his fellow investors. They were all doing great. They had a good thing going. They said, you've got to get these colonies under control. You have to do it. You're the emperor over there. Need we remind you? And under political pressure, that's what happens to men. I think we see, and it's impossible to avoid. So again, I'm not criticizing. I've been in that position myself, and I realize what kind of pressure comes when people think you may have power in your hands. It's overwhelming, utterly overwhelming. And I think I see some indications of that in DJ Trump. And it's to be expected. That's why we need to root for a man who might have his head headed in the right direction. He's going to have temptation. And problems. And he needs our support as long as we think he's got a chance. Now, if he abandons us and goes south entirely, that's something quite different. And then it's time to cut off connections and do something else. But we're not a government of men. Again, common law country. We're a government of law. We're not looking for a savior. We're not looking for a messiah. We're not looking for a hero. We're looking for law. And the only remedy to lawlessness, and we see it. If you can't see it, your eyes are blinded. We live in lawlessness like we haven't seen in many decades before my lifetime, probably a long time before that, lawlessness, utter lawlessness. And the only remedy to it is true law. And that true law comes in two volumes. Our Declaration of 76 references those, the laws of nature. Unwritten in the nature of things, lex non scripta, Blackstone calls it, and the laws of nature of God, written in the Bible, lex scripta, Blackstone tells us. Well, we made a little headway. Appreciate it, John, and thanks for letting me come on again. Again, I like to say always at the end, if I remember it, my opinions may or may not be the opinions of National Liberty Alliance, but my guess is most of them probably are. Thanks, John. Whoever, or Gerard, whoever's there.
Yeah, it's me. Thanks, Brent. Okay. We appreciate that. Okay. Well, we got California Ed in the queue, and I will open that up if you got a question for me or Brent. Go ahead. Well, I think you know what? We got Harley. Get back in there, California Ed. I guess my button threw you out. But Harley, you're open. Go ahead, Harley. Hello, Harley. I hear you that clicking in the background. Harley William. Sounds like he's cooking beans over there or something. Hello, Harley. All right. I'm going to open up Florida Felicia. It's not letting me open it. I don't know what's the matter with this thing. Hello, Felicia. Try to see if you are unmuted.
She still shows muted on my panel.
Now
there
you go. Yep. There, Felicia's open. Got rid of Harley and somebody else. Go ahead, Felicia. Yeah, you're unmuted, Felicia. Go ahead. Hello?
Well, it says mute on one spot and unmute on the other.
Really? Let me
unmute you. Did that unmute you?
I just didn't work.
Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Okay. I had a couple of let's see. Okay. If any member of the Bar Association, which I first learned is British Accreditation Registry and or lawyers aren't considered to be a United States citizen under the Titles of Nobility Amendment, which they can't hold a seat in Congress, how is it that they hold a seat? Are they considered to have dual citizenship between the two in order to be a practicing attorney and or lawyer or esquire under the title of nobility?
Okay, well, go ahead, Brent. I was going to say, 13th Amendment was enforced, that would be true, but they...
There is also something within the Constitution concerning those who hold some kind of a title of nobility, and I think what they're really talking about is the esquire. I do know from meeting up with Brent that there are other lawyers that do not participate somehow in that, but it has to do really with the school. And I know the American Bar Association. We have a paper that was written. I think it was a congressional paper. I'm not sure what it was, but we do have a paper that was written by someone or some group concerning the facts with the problems with bar attorneys that hold the title of esquire, but it's being taught by a particular school, and that's quite some time ago. So I don't know where it is today learning, but I do know that very few schools out there really teach the Constitution to these people who are becoming attorneys. Clearly, they don't teach the common law to these people, and therein is the problem. But let me let Brent speak, because he's got a little more knowledge than we do concerning how things work from the Bar Association and also lawyers and so on and so forth. Brent, go right ahead.
Well, this comes up pretty often, and it's come up over the years, and I can speak to my experience and, of course, the experience of a good many lawyers I've known. I can tell you for a fact I have never taken an oath to, as a lawyer, I had to take an oath when I became licensed. I had to take an oath, just like other people that are officers of government, in state or federal. Our Constitution requires this, state or federal. I'm an officer of the court where I'm licensed. I had to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution against foreign and domestic enemies. And that's the oath that lawyers take, as far as I know. I know it's where I was. I took it. I've had to take it when I've been admitted to practice in other jurisdictions, federal or state. And I have seen no evidence anywhere in all these years of any lawyer in America being admitted to a title of nobility in this theory about BAR and what it refers to and says that lawyers are, if it's true, I've never seen it. Now, it is true that lawyers get to doing things they had not to be doing, and they organize themselves in the bar associations. I've said it here before, I'll say it again to stress it. I don't belong to any bar association, never have. And the reason I don't do it is because it's a voluntary association, the National Bar Association, the American Bar, the ABA. It has a lot of sway and influence and power. But it's a voluntary organization. I've never belonged to it. I know a lot of lawyers that have refused or dropped their membership because of the left-wing wacko ideas and the things they promote and use the money to promote. I don't want any part of it. And then each of the states have a bar association, and in some states, it depends on the state, but there are two ways lawyers are governed in our United States. Lawyers initially are licensed to practice within the courts of a state, usually where they live. And the discipline of lawyers, the control of lawyers, is in one of two ways, depending upon the state. Either the highest court of that state has control of lawyers, or the Bar Association has control of lawyers. If the highest court of the state has control of lawyers, there's no requirement that lawyers join the state Bar Association. But if the Bar Association in a state, like California, for example, is this way, if where the Bar Association has jurisdiction over the discipline of lawyers, then Bar Association membership is mandatory if you're going to be a lawyer in that state and practice law. You have to. Every lawyer in California belongs to the California Bar. If you don't join the California Bar, you lose your license. That's simple. You can't practice. That's not true in Indiana, in Illinois, for example. Illinois, the Supreme Court of Illinois controls lawyers. So in that state, you don't have to belong to the Bar Association, but the Bar Association is there. And I know people, by the way, anybody that's listening can join the Bar Association in your state. I know it's that way in a lot of states, and I'll bet it's that way in every state. And I know people that aren't lawyers that join the Bar Association because they want to get the journal and they want to get the daily emails of cases that have been handed down. If you join and pay the fee to the Bar Association, there are certain perks and benefits you get. That's why people join. But this thing about lawyers being a part of the peerage of England, but the other thing is this, lawyers in England in the old days and even up till present, they're not part of the peerage. They never have been. And lawyers in the United States have never been part of the peerage. The peerage in England do not include lawyers. Lawyers have prestige in their own way there because of what they do. There's very class-conscious people over there. And a barrister in England, a license to practice before the courts, and one then those are called sergeants of law. And then there are at law, they're protectors of law, the idea. And then there are people called solicitors. They're licensed to practice law, but they do it as researchers and as informers of people. And the peerage in England is it's an old word. It just means that there are certain people that are on the same level. That's really fundamentally what the word peer means. We get our word pair, P-A-I-R, like a pair of shoes. It's the same root. And then we have in our common law tradition the idea of peers of the court. It depends on how the word is used. We're to be tried by a jury of our peers. What does that mean? Well, fundamentally and anciently, that means fellow members of the militia in Anglo-Saxon England called the Ferd. That's what that means. Peers are your fellow militia members. And if you're a male and you're able-bodied, well, then you have, you're to be tried by your peers. Well, the word peerage, when you put A-G-E on the end, it refers to the people in England that are of the higher rank, and these are hereditary titles. They carry hereditary benefits. And you, if you're a peer in England, then you can belong to the House of Lords. And when your father's gone, you inherit the right to belong to the House of Lords, and on and on it goes. That's a whole different thing. We don't do that in America. Matter of fact, our Constitution forbids it. But to just sum up quickly, lawyers in America, I would bet, I've never met one that belonged to any, as part of any peerage of England. I know I'm not. I never had an opportunity. I've never known of an opportunity to belong. And I know that me being a lawyer doesn't make me belong. I can speak for myself for sure. Wow. Back to you.
Well, let me. I'd like to share some stuff that people can take a look at, and maybe we could discuss at a later date. But there is a paper, a congressional report, concerning some problems with lawyers particularly. But if you go out to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury, click on docket. And one of the papers we did file in as evidence was a congressional report on the Lawyers Guild. Okay, so people would want to read that. It's under evidence. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 from the down. It's in alphabetical order. Congressional Report, Lawyers Guild. Now, just real quickly, this took place. This committee came together, an all house, and ordered this paper to be printed. In September 21st, 1950. And it was right after that, I believe. It could have been maybe a year earlier or a year later, but in this general area was a committee that came together concerning un-American activities taking place within our government. And the chief investigator for that was an individual named Norman Dodd. And you can find a video. It's just under an hour long. It seems a lot longer. This guy talks a little slow and everything, but he gives so much information. It seems, you know, he's just filled with information. But Norman Dodd, on the Tax Exempt Foundations, the investigation was on un-American activities in Congress and within our government, and then this is the report that this individual. He tells the story on the investigation and what was discovered and this great conspiracy, a huge conspiracy within our government to destroy the American way of life. And so it's fascinating, very interesting. We do have somewhere on our website the actual report. We don't have it listed on our docket page. Maybe we should put it on our docket page. But anyway, that's on un-American activity. Now, the report, the report of the National Lawyers Guild, and it reads this way: Report of the National Lawyers Guild, legal bulwark of the Communist Party. And it basically start. And again, it was in 1950. And it basically just the beginning of the reading of this. It's about 60 pages. The National Lawyers Guild is the foremost legal bulwark of the Communist Party. Its front organization and controlled unions since its inception, it has never failed to rally to the legal defense of the Communist Party and individual members thereof, including known espionage agents. It has consistently fought against national, state, and local legislation aimed at curbing the Communist conspiracy. It has been most articulate in its attacks upon all agencies of the government seeking to expose or prosecute the subversive activities of the Communist Network, including national, state, and local investigative committees, the Department of Justice, the FBI, and law enforcement agencies generally. Through its affiliation with the International Association of Democratic Lawyers, an international communist front organization, the National Lawyers Guild has constituted itself an agent of a foreign principle hostile to the interests of the United States. It has gone far afield to oppose the foreign policies of the United States in line with the current line of the Soviet Union. So anyway, if people read this report and they understand the seriousness of what's being taken place here, this communist conspiracy to destroy America, and those of us who were raised in the 50s and the 60s particularly remember where Khrushchev came over, and he said that America is going to be taken over by the Communist Party, but it's going to be the American people that's going to raise the flag. And so there was an understanding from Khrushchev, and I think that was in 62 or 63. I think it was during Kennedy's administration that he made these statements. But in any event, this report really is very revealing, and it shows the inability of Congress to deal with this problem. This particular report, again, I don't know if the investigation of the Reese Committee started either prior or after. Again, I think it was after. I think 52, 53, somewhere in there, 54. And again, that was an investigation on the un-American activities within our government, and they were trying to figure out what they're going to do about it. And it's very interesting how that turned out and how that was squashed. But that report is there too, and I know we have it on our website, but I should probably move it over into evidence. I'll see about doing that, the actual report. So hopefully that's helpful. Yeah.
That parallels perfectly with the National and International Association of Judges that they all belong to.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Yes.
And that's why they don't have an oath to the Constitution. And Ollie and I worked on that report from Tron and broke it up into smaller videos. We should have a paper in there also on that, because that's what's wrong with the courts. These judges are beholden to an international association that says that the judges are autonomous and they need to be free. And you should see all the stuff that's in that report. Ollie and I started working on it. We kind of dropped the ball.
You're talking about this report that I'm reading?
No, I'm talking about a report just like that, but not on the bar, on the Judges Association.
Well, on page 11, it talks to that. It says, not only has the behavior of Guild attorneys have been noted officially by several federal judges, but the American Bar Association in 1949 received from its Board of Governors a recommendation that the American Bar Association bar from membership any person holding membership in the National Lawyers Guild. The action was based on the grounds that guild lawyers held beliefs incompatible with membership in the American Bar Association. Now, there's more on here about the bar, but I'm just trying to, go through this and see if I can find it. But that didn't really support what you were saying, but it made a point.
Yeah, Association of Judges, which is basically the same mechanism that basically turns over the control of the judges to the UN. It's an international body, and it starts at the town. It starts right from the town level with the State Magistrates Association, and it goes all the way up. And the International Judges and Magistrates Association is run in the UN. It's a communist organization, and that's who these judges have an oath to, and that's who they're listening to. Matter of fact, Judge Navarro, her words on the bench when she was over there violating their rights, it's almost word for word what's in that article. She's beholden to that association and what they're training them how to run their court.
Well, it is absolutely clear, in my opinion, that the National Lawyers Guild has ultimately poisoned the Bar Association. I mean, goodness, we're looking at a report that's 60, 70 years old, and nothing was done about it. It just sat there, okay? And even with the Reese Committee, and, you know, they were looking to take people down, okay? And it just sat there. It didn't go anywhere. No one was convicted. If no one was removed from power or authority, nothing was done, okay? These people committed crimes. I mean, anybody who looked into this report that Norman Dodd had done, the chief investigator in the Reese Committee, I mean, these people should be in jail. They caused wars. They've changed the opinion of a nation by causing wars. They talk about how they created the monetary collapse back in the 20s and the 30s. Okay. They were all responsible for all of that. That's what this guy uncovered. It's huge, the damage and that they have done, the subversion, and yet nobody has been arrested, nobody has gone to jail, nothing has been done, and everything's been buried. Now, you look, I'll tell you what, as far as the lawyers that I have come in contact with, and as far as the lawyers that, and the judges that I have come in contact and heard, as far as I'm concerned, they're all communists. They're straight-out communists. And they're all bar members. So it has really gotten really bad. But it is true, you know. I mean, we have Brent with us, and again, he understands what our position is, and he holds his position pretty close, if not identical to us in many, many ways. And so, therefore, there are some lawyers out there. Again, I haven't met only but one, but there are some lawyers out there that see it differently or haven't become aware of the problem and are not participating in it. But I'm sure Brent does, because he's mentioned from time to time, he sees that there's problems in the courts, that these judges are out of control, people are being abused, and it's just appalling, you know, and we're all seeing it. But anyway.
Hey, I have another question.
2.5 cents.
I have another question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
If gold and silver certificates are considered to have real monetary value, is this the reason why former President of the United States, former Franklin D. Roosevelt, implemented Executive Order Number 6102, confiscating all gold certificates from citizens, which involuntarily put all citizens of the United States, no matter what color, creed, race, beliefs, etc., into slavery as debtors, as this infrastructure has labeled almost the entire population as a corporation and not a human being, which is a fictitious name in all caps commonly known as the straw man? Was President Roosevelt intimidated by them? Because from what I can see, gold and silver is on the rise.
Well, President Roosevelt was part of the problem. He succumbed to them, these individuals. He's really led the communist movement in this country, in my opinion, as far as the president is concerned. But he's not the only one. The presidents before him also were a major problem. But look at they have enslaved the American people, and they've done a lot of things from their perspective and their belief. You know, the people who understand how they've constructed the statutory prison that we do sit in, and how the process works and the control of the Federal Reserve and the IRS and all that stuff, you know, I mean, that's debtors. They set up debtors' prisons and everything there. And so we are enslaved to them from one standpoint. They believe that, and they intend on, and as long as we believe that, then we are slaves. You know, the first thing a person has to do in order to get out of slavery is to deny slavery, to deny that they want to be free. No matter what the consequence, they're going to be free. And they make that statement, and they make that stand wherever it is that they can and do make that stand. And, you know, these people can be beaten, but it's very, very rare. It's very, very difficult. And at some point in time, we're not going to be able to beat them unless we take these people out of power and bring them to judgment. They need to be brought before courts of law and judged by we the people, you know. And until that happens, we are in danger of total slavery. But, you know, there are a lot of forces out there. I see them suffering, as Gerard says, what is it, the thousand cuts? Are they suffering from the, how do you put that, Gerard?
Death of a thousand cuts.
Yeah, I see it all over. Look what this president is doing. Look what we're doing. And you know what? What's very interesting is, you know, a lot of organizations, all the big ones and even a lot of the little ones, are listed as potential terrorists. I mean, even Ron Paul and their followers, his followers, is listed on the terrorist, you know, sheet. What was that? What's the name of that group, that lawyer group that has a list out there? Right, that. Our name is not on any of these lists. National Liberty Alliance is not on that list. And
that's
I perceive...
you have no credit, John.
Yeah, there you go. I perceive because we... They're not sure of us. They don't understand us. Okay?
Well, they did have...
And it's a dangerous thing to put us on that list, I think. Because we're going into courts, and we would definitely bring that into the courts with us.
You know what? They had us listed locally, and then they took us off. Remember when we got into a spat with them? The guy wrote an article, and then you wrote back and went back and forth a little bit. And then after that, they took our name off. They erased everything. They didn't want no part of us, I guess.
Well, that was when they had that group spying on us. Is that what you're talking about?
There was an article done by one of the guys from the Southern Poverty Law against us, saying that we were subversive and this and that.
And we had that guy was a double agent. He came in, and we thought he was on our side. And meanwhile, he was on the other side. But that's a crime. This is a crime.
They had us listed in New York State as in their fusion center, and they still do probably. But on their website, they don't use our name, and I think that they're afraid that they'll end up in court and they'll lose.
I think so too. Yeah, that tells us something.
Yeah.
One more question for Mr. Brent. Is there any correlation between the 13 states which proposed the title of amendment of nobility, the title of nobility amendment into the Constitution, and its correlation to the 13 colonies? Is there any correlation between that?
Are you talking about the 13th Amendment, though? Did you mean to say the 13th Amendment? Oh, okay.
And the correlation between the 13 colonies, is there any correlation between the two?
Not to my knowledge either.
I think that's just coincidental.
Yeah.
It's very interesting that there's a 13. This is a Christian nation. People can claim anything they want that's not, but this is a Christian nation, whole and whole, and that's it. There is no debate in the facts of that. But when you take that fact, you know, the idea that there were 13 states, okay, is a very interesting idea that this nation was created with 13. Because, you know, in the Bible, the 12 is there are 12 apostles, and yet there was also referred to as the 13th apostle. And there was also 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament, right. But there was actually 13. I forget which tribe it was broken up into two. And so you had 13 tribes. God never mentioned any more than 12 at any given time in his breath. You know, he'd name 12, but he'd never name the 13 together. Well, over here, he'd name the 12 again and might include the other one. But there's that 12 and 13, and I've come to understand, again, you know, this number 13 is really an idea of the fullness with the enemy in the gates.
And here we got
with the 13 states, and you know, that number 13 shows up in a few different ways. It's interesting and something to wonder and ponder about. You know,
it's just that when I take the civics course, I also take notes, and it's like, okay, so I just come up with the questions.
Yeah. Well, you know, you go into the book of Job, just to make another point on this, the sons of God came together and called, and then Satan came amongst them. So, you know, I see that number 13 as the fullness of God's people with Satan also amongst them, you know, that weed that's in there. And that weed certainly was in the creation of our nation. It was certainly amongst us even there.
Yes, sir. I heard the verse of Matthew you spoke at the beginning, and it's like, okay, so I understood that clearly. So,
mm-hmm. Brent, do you want to comment on any of these?
Oh no, just to say there are a lot of coincidences like that. Words sound alike, or numbers correlate. It's easy to jump to the conclusion that there's some connection, but I feel it has to be careful. I like to quote Albright, William Foxwell Albright. They say he was the greatest archaeologist of the Near East that America, no, that the world ever produced. He happens to be an American, William Foxwell Albright. He studied a lot of languages, ancient languages, probably knew them better than anybody. He said at one time that vermicelli has no relationship to wormy celery. It sounds the same, but it's not the same thing. And asparagus, he said asparagus has no relationship to sparagrass. So it's easy to jump to conclusions. Indeed, when things sound alike or there are correlations of numbers, sometimes there's a connection. But it is important always to check them out real close and follow them through and make sure that it's just not a coincidence, because there are a lot of coincidences in the world.
Agreed.
We're all connected. That's why we're here.
Okay,
well,
anything
13,
else?
13, I don't think there's a connection between...
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm
13,
talking about
the
NLA movement.
In general, right, but to make particular connections. But appreciate your question, though.
Gerard?
I was going to, you know, she brought up the fact that Roosevelt outlawed gold, which was a big scam, you know, and then when they put the backing back in, they made a windfall profit overnight. That's what that scam was about, you know, and now people can buy it again. You know, they lifted that. Of course, Nixon took us off the standard that the dollar's no longer backed up, you know, with gold, right?
Well, Kennedy tried to do that first.
Yeah, that's how he ended up dead.
I'm sorry, not to take us off, but to bring us back by bringing the silver certificate back.
But right now, it's not illegal to own gold. When Roosevelt did that, you had to turn it in under pain of, you know, being a felon or whatever. So I don't think they'll ever pull that scam again. I think the people have, if they said you got to turn your goal in tomorrow, I can't, it's like, it would be like the SAFE Act and having to register your gun, and it would be about as successful as that, where they got less than 1% of the guns out there registered. I don't think anybody would turn their goal in.
But
you
they
know.
Voluntarily did it, Mr. Jan, when they, did this thing, buy your gold for cash, and they made millions of dollars off of it, especially from the pawn shop.
It was the biggest scam going. I mean, and
yeah, it was.
I think the whole world is awake to that now. I don't think the people were much more trusting of the government back then than they are today. And Americans are the most trusting people out there. At least in Europe and Eastern Europe, they know their governments are always playing with them. They never trust their governments. The Italians, even England has more sense than Americans do. People, but America's waking up. But for many, many years, Americans would walk around and say, oh, my government would never do that. You'd reveal something that they're doing, and they would just refuse to believe that the government would ever do that. You know, they have our, you know, their benevolence. You know, they have our best wishes at heart. Well, that whole idea is almost dead today, I think. I think the average person does not trust the government. And I don't think the government's going to be able to pull those scams anymore in this climate. I think people are waking up, and I don't think they dare try it. Anyway, that's just, you know. And, you know, I also had heard just another interesting thing, you know, you talk about the Federal Reserve and the U.S. citizen and all that. That when Roosevelt did those things and announced that thing, that in order for it to be legal, he had to publicly announce it, and he used his fireside chats to bring it to the nation. And because nobody objected, it became law. But there was a legal scholar that said, listen, he said, that law is only binding on the people who were over 21 that day and who are still alive, which now they would be in their 90s. So he said any contract that they think they made with the people expired with the last of those people who have now died, because you and I did not consent to that. That was for those people at that time when he announced it. Now, of course, they're not going to listen to that, but technically speaking, it's like another maxim of law where in law, silence is acquiescence. That's how he got it in, because nobody objected. But there also is a a limitation on that, kind of like a statute of limitation, if you would, that was only binding on those people who were of age in that day and that consented to that by their silence, but it expires in their lifetime. And he did put a, they claim that he put a remedy in there where they're supposed to be paying our public debts from that money that they stole from us. But the only one who's getting paid out of that is the government, because you go to jail, that's the fund, that's that Cescue account that they dig into, that you'll never get into it, but the county and the jails and the government has all that information of the bond that they made out of your birth certificate based on what Roosevelt did. Anyway, that's just for your own for information. I don't think it means a whole lot in this day and age, because I think that issue is going to be a dead issue anyway with all the other stuff that's going on. I wouldn't hang my hat on it, you know what I mean?
I just wanted to know, because I was taking a civics course, and when he was speaking, that's, the thing that came to my mind, and that's the question I wrote to ask. So.
Okay, that was good. Is that it?
I send you.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We have one other caller. We have Jeremiah again. You've been unmuted.
Okay, so thank you for unmuting me, Gerard. My question is for anyone, really, but I would really like to hear from Brent on this, and my question is about the impact of organizing at the township level as heads of household to implement the common law and the possibilities there under.
Well, the governments of men, this is my study conviction, the governments of men will never work unless there's government in your house, in your family. However it may be, however fractured, however dysfunctional it may be, if folk will commit to doing what God wants at home, then it can make a difference at the township level, at the courthouse level. We used to say, when I was in politics, it doesn't matter what happens in the state house, the White House. What matters is what happens in your house. That's fact, because the government of God is founded upon the family. There's no question about it. That's the way he reveals it to us in the Bible. And the chief problem in the governments of men, this needs to be said forthrightly, it's ignored entirely. The chief problem, the key problem in the governments of men is the relationship between men and their wives, and wives and their men. However you want to say it, backwards, forwards, either way, that's the chief problem with government. It is, if that were fixed, if that's the building block, if that were fixed, or I shouldn't say use the word fixed, but if that relationship were right, if men were committed to their duty as men, then the governments at the like you say, the township level, and it's a beautiful structure we have here. We're just not using it. What's a township to anybody? Nobody even knows. Those are the old hundreds, the hundreds of England, and the hundreds of England embraced about 100 persons, 100 militia members, able-bodied men, and it was organized for a national defense, but the hundreds, they called them hundreds, and the hundreds were brought to America. They had them in Pennsylvania. They divided the townships, counties, townships, and then down to the hundreds. And Delaware, New Jersey, I think the only state in the United States where hundreds are still exist are in and recognized are in New Jersey, the way I remember reading. But they don't really mean anything. But used to be there was a hundred court right at the back door of every person almost. And so justice was easy to get at. But coming back to what we have to do as Americans, if all the women in the world, all the women in America, fell on their faces before the true lawgiver and repented, it wouldn't make any difference to straighten our country up. It wouldn't make any difference. It'd be a good thing for them, I suppose. But they aren't the problem. Men are the problem. Men are the problem. And Paul the Apostle tells us in the New Testament that the race of Adam didn't fall into depravity when Eve made the trespass. The trespass that drove us into depravity is when And when Adam, our grandpa, made the trespass, the reason for that is Paul, the apostle, tells us he had the discernment to know the difference. God gave it to him. And the female of the species did what she did in ignorance. She thought it was okay. She really did. But her husband, he knew with a high hand and full knowledge what he was doing. And that's why we're in this mess. And so that's why it says, if my people will hear my voice and humble themselves, that I will heal their land. I believe that's 2 Chronicles 7:14. And the key phrase there is the people. The people in the New, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, that phrase is throughout both Testaments. It it always refers to the armed, the able-bodied, armed, able to bear a weapon in battle, the militia of the 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament and God's people in the New Testament. It's to the men, not the women. They're the problem. Go ahead.
Interesting. I was going to ask you about the people, because you're on a bunch of different topics here, but the people as being separate from the de facto state now. I mean, and under our Republican form of government, the people are the state in a de jure sense of the phrase. My question is, at what point do the people, become something du jour as distinct from the de facto state? Is it only to enforce those military doctrines that were associated with the 100 courts?
Well, the people are the able-bodied males, and that have been able-bodied males. It refers to those that can conduct two duties, jury duty and armed defense. And that's why our oath, anciently, we still use it. It's in our Constitution. Enemies foreign, that's armed defense. Enemies domestic, that's jury duty. To defend the law of the land and the courts and to be willing to participate in that process is anciently the duty of the what they call the FIRD, F-Y-R-D. We call it today the militia. It was the governments of men. And that was their two duties. And I do think it's a good idea to try to reestablish that at the township level, and we need to appoint more judges and bring the courts locally. William Blackstone says in his commentaries that the glory of our common law in Anglo-Saxon England before the Norman invasion, before Magna Carta, was that justice was available at the back door of every cottier. A cottier was a man that lived in a cottage. He was just a fellow that had his own little five-acre piece of property, and he lived on it. And he could go to court by just walking down the road a little ways. That's the true story, and that was the glory of our common law. It brought justice to the back door of every cottage. But we don't have that today. We're to the point now where we have to worry about getting shaken down just to get in the courthouse. Now, yeah, there's some courthouses around these counties where I live where you don't have that.
Right. But let me ask you, Brent. Let's have a conversation here about this. Is it the de facto law that they are enforcing when they shake you down as you enter the courthouse?
Well, though these words de jure and de facto are too fancy for me. Either it's the fact of the matter or it isn't. And there, are, if it's the way it is and it isn't going to change, it's the law. Whether you call it de jure or de facto, and who's passing these laws or who's responsible for the security of the courthouses is usually the sheriff of the county. That's the way it is around here anyway. And they make those decisions. Now, I've had some courthouses tell me that it's the chief judge of the circuit that makes that decision whether or not they're going to shake you down and have all the metal detecting machines and all that. But I think that's probably true. He would make that decision, but the sheriff is responsible for courthouse security in any event.
I see.
And the one that carries that out.
Because
is that what you're asking about? What are you?
Yeah,
asking
yeah,
about?
Yeah. You totally answered the question. It was very succinct and brief. You did a good job. But I'm not
always brief.
a civil township, okay, is widely, according to Wikipedia, widely used. Is a widely used unit of local government in the United States, subordinate to a county. They talk about the specific responsibility and the degree of autonomy, okay, based on each stake. Okay, and so these townships, like you said, in many of them, townships are organized and operated under the authority of the state statute, similar to the countries. In others, townships operate as municipal corporations, chartered entities with a degree of home rule. There are some exceptions, the most notable ones being New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where townships are a class of incorporation with fixed boundaries and equal standing to a village town, borough, or city, analogous to a New England town or towns in New York. And then there's the survey township, which has more to do with public land survey. But I suppose the reason I'm bringing it up is because I was recently doing a study into that area of application of the government and the people as the government at the township level. And I was wondering if you could basically, is that something that NLA would sponsor and get behind? Thank you.
Well, I don't know. NLA, you'd have to talk to the leaders of NLA about that. I've never talked to them about it, but that might be something they want to bring up. But I do believe the township is part of the key to trying to bring government back local, because increasingly the whole tenor of the evil empire is to centralize. We don't even have courthouses anymore. I've been to places where they call courthouses government centers. See, they use words that get us accustomed to the idea of let's get everything centered. Let's take it to the state capitol. Let Washington, D.C. handle it. And we have, when I was growing up, we had schoolhouses scattered out all across the countryside. But there was a process occurring when I was growing up called consolidation. And slowly but surely, the country schools were being shut down, and everybody was being bused to town because they wanted centralization. And after they bused them to town, to the schools, then the schools who they bused them to, they began to consolidate, and some counties now have county school systems, just one high school in the county, and instead of two or three in the little towns around. The constant centralization is going on, and this is the policy of the evil empire. Draw all men into the city of Babylon. That's where it all started. We got a big tower here. It's beautiful, and it's a point of rally. Of course, the idea is to get centralization, get people drawn in. You have a single city, such as Washington, D.C., who rules the country. That's called empire. That's what empire is. Empire is the law of the city extended out over the territory of the land around it, extending its terror, and that's why it's called the territory, extending its terror and ruling all of the places. The British kind of conformed that a little bit, and they said, we're a country that rules our empire. But amazingly, now the language is going back, and places like the Vatican and places like the State of Israel are calling themselves city-states. City-states like the ancient city-states of Greece, and then they rule their territory from around. Well, that's what the Vatican is doing. And they're talking that way in those terms, this Pope they've got in there now. And then there's absolute immunity, of course, in cases like that. And the number two man now in the Vatican was taken from Australia, called in there to straighten out, supposedly, the finances of the Vatican. Well, he's the number two man, most powerful man, they say, in the Roman See. Well, now he's been indicted for 50 years of running a pedophilia ring in Australia and around the world out of Australia. Well, that's not unusual. That's common when you have people that are in a priesthood, that they're elite, and the Vatican, being a city-state, had the people that are there have immunity. So he's there. He has immunity. He can't be extradited, supposedly. And Israel has those kind of laws. There's no extradition treaty between the United States and Israel for tax crimes, for example. You can bag up the money and go to Israel, and especially if you're an Israeli citizen, or you want to be one, they might let you in. But anyway, you would have immunity. That's what's developing in the world, and the elite want these places where they can go and not be immune from prosecution. This comes back to the law of the city, centralization of the city-states. Here in America, we have the machinery in place to decentralize, and we can we have townships, and we should use them. This fellow that was killed a number of years ago up in Iowa, Call, he was murdered terribly. His son's now in prison for life. it was a terrible situation. But that's what he was trying to do the night he was, he ended up shooting some federal agents. Long ugly story, but he was in the process in a rural community trying to establish township authority and trying to establish government at the local level. And we need to be doing that. Our townships, now the townships here, I can only speak around here, I know for years, there is a township government here, and townships where I'm from take care of the people that are poor and homeless and starving in rural areas. And one, I had a friend who was a township trustee here in a rural area. There were no towns in this township. It was just a township. And but they had money for people that didn't have jobs. And there was one fellow went and applied for money, for rent for his family and all. And this fellow, he's deceased now. I kind of grew up with him, Gary Tingley. He got him a chainsaw, and he got him plenty of fuel, and he got him started cutting brush out along the road and around the cemetery, a lot of cemeteries in town. And he said, we're going to give you a welfare, we want you to work. Well, I think it was against the law that he did that, or somebody said it was, but he didn't care, he did it anyway. And it worked out pretty good. The fellow felt like he was working for a little money, and he was. But that's township government, and that's what we ought to have in America. But I say, in America, we have all, near all of the machinery of our common law. It's all here. We're just not using it. The pump, the machinery, it's just sitting in cold iron. Nobody's got it fired up.
Right.
You need to get the boilers fired up and go with it. Now, yeah. Sure, you know,
so,
all the things. So
would you say,
yeah.
Would you say that the offices are vacant then? The offices of the, this complicated word, du jour republic, are vacant because this supposed time of war or emergency that we're in right now demands that a reasonable community, take up the concept of townships, right?
Oh, that's right. But it's hard to do. It's hard to do because they'll accuse you of usurping, going beyond the state statutes and state jurisdiction. But what people ought to do, it's the old idea they used to have in New England. I was in New England not long ago, and it was amazing. Now, all the things I'd read about in the books up in New Hampshire, driving down through the mountain roads, you see just constantly meeting houses. Every little village has a meeting house. They all look alike. They're kind of stoic-looking, congregational-looking, like a lot of them were congregational churches, people told me, but their old style was there. Well, of course, I don't know if they use them anymore. I don't know if they have their town meetings anymore. But now when I was at home, when I was younger, we had township buildings, the old Grange buildings. There were some of those around, and people would meet in those and have dinners and reunions and things. And, of course, we had the township buildings. Some of them were just schoolhouses, and we used to meet there. We used to have dances. I remember square dances in the schoolhouses when I was a teenager. But people would also get together there and have meetings. And they could call a meeting. What laws are you breaking? What law could you possibly be breaking? Just calling a local meeting on some subject. And people used to do that. Of course, churches serve that way too. And churches, if they're still there, they should be an important part of the mix. The civil rights movement of the 60s, which some of us remember very well. Go ahead. Civil rights movement was through the churches in the South of the black community. Now, you may agree with what they were doing, you may disagree with what they were doing, but nonetheless, the fact remains, the churches were key to that, and they ought to be key to what we're doing today if we really believe in what we're doing. Go ahead.
Can anybody hear me?
I can hear you.
All righty, then. How's everybody tonight? How are you, Brent?
Well, I'm all right.
I think Gerard just dropped me in. This is Harley.
Oh, this is Harley. I'm sorry. I thought this was the fellow that called you. Couldn't assume the
difference. I apologize.
That's all right, Harley. So it's just me and you, or is there other people on? Are there other people on?
I think we're winding down, but probably people are listening. I just wanted to put in a quick plug for working on affidavits.
Yeah.
They have a nice little... very simple template, basically has the signing spot on it for the notary and whatnot. But basically you're just trying to cut fact from opinion fiction and get some blurbs on
on paper with people and get them down to their local notary. And it's not rocket surgery. Not everybody wants to wake up and do it, but there's just a whole lot of pressing things, and that's one of the things we're going to be known for, is doing something consistent and well, and that's placing all this kindling at their feet as they get ready to set the judiciary on fire. So I just wanted to put that out there. Volunteers wanted. Talk to you know, leadership, and get on the bandwagon. We're having fun. Affidavits.
Thank you, Harley. Listen, I know it's late, but I don't know, maybe you could help me, Jan. There's Shane Duvall from Redoubt News wanted to ask a question about the indictment. I kind of wanted to give him a couple seconds, but I don't know what phone he's on. Or is he on with you, Ollie? I don't know. Let me see. You have to get in the queue. We only got a couple seconds left here. But I'd like to hear what his question is on this indictment that we're going to do on Wednesday. I don't know if he's on Ollie's phone or if he's on his own phone here. Go in the queue. What is it? Star 6 and then 1. Dial star 6 and then 1.
Agreed.
All right. Well, I don't know. Well, I guess we won't be able to get them. I think, what time is it now? It's already, well, we got 5 minutes, so I don't know. I kind of knocked off Jeremiah there because I had two people I wanted to get in there. Let's see. I don't see him. Is Ollie in there? Ollie. Well, let me just look a little bit here. I don't see him. Well, okay. I guess that's it. I don't know. Who just jumped back into queue? Is that you, Harley?
I'm not sure. Am I still here? I keep trying to mute.
Oh, okay. All right, well, I guess we're done. We don't have anybody else left, and it's close enough. It's 2 minutes of, so I'm going to go ahead and shut it down. And Ollie, if Shane wants to talk, have any questions, let him get a hold of me. I'll talk to him off of the call. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thanks, Gerard.
Yes. Yes, who was that?
Oh, Brent.
Yes.
We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Brent. Goodbye, everybody, and we'll see you here same time, same station next week on Monday night. Thank you very much. God bless and have a good week.